Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Let us now take a closer look at how, in reality, the world is dealing with this pandemic, which is without any basis. I would like to first focus on those who claim that, well, but many people are dying. People are dying in Bergamo. People are dying in New York. So let us start with taking first a look at why that happened, and then we will take a closer look at how else, how can it be treated? I mean, we all know there is a virus out there, but how can it be treated? Let's first take a look at the question, why is this happening? And Brian Artis is with us, Dr. Brian Artis from Texas. How do you explain the fact that so many people seem to have died in New York, for example, of the corona or from the coronavirus?
Yeah, it's a great question. From the beginning of May 2020,
I had that same question because in March and April of 2020, there was nonstop reports in the media from doctors, hospital administrators in New York City who were complaining and relating the same scenario. Every time they were asked by the media, what are you seeing in patients you're treating with COVID-19 in hospitals here in New York? They all said the same thing, all of them. We have never seen a respiratory virus ever do this before. From the time we start treating this respiratory virus, by day 3, 4, and 5 of treatment, the virus goes from the lungs and then it starts attacking the kidneys and causing severe acute kidney failure that we've never seen before. And they kept saying, we're not only short on ventilators here in New York, we're also short on dialysis machines. So this was very intriguing to me. I actually had a similar scenario just 3 months earlier from May of 2020 when I was watching all these reports in the media. My own father-in-law had died in a hospital from ill-advised protocols in early February of 2020, and I and my wife received a phone call on day 3 of his treatment for the flu that he was going into acute kidney failure, only to find out it was a drug he was put on, ill-advised for the flu, that actually was known to cause acute kidney failure. Unrelated to COVID, 3 months later, I'm reading this May memo from Anthony Fauci of the NIH because I'm curious, why is it that all these doctors, nurses, hospital administrators in New York keep reporting the same thing I experienced? Day 3, 4, and 5 of treatment for a supposed virus in New York called COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, they were seeing high amounts of acute kidney failure. So I went to the CDC.gov's website. They did not have a protocol for treating COVID-19 hospitalized patients, but they referred back to the NIH's protocol for COVID-19. And on that actual memo, I hyperlinked it to the NIH.gov. This is where Anthony Fauci had a memo for the entire world. This was in the middle of May 2020. And he said there is only one drug and one drug only that we're authorizing to be used in all hospitals across America for COVID-19 hospitalized Americans. That one experimental antiviral drug is called remdesivir. There's 2 studies supporting its use. It was found safe and effective against the Ebola virus a year prior in Africa. Then he said it was found safe and effective in a trial in March of 2020, just 2 months earlier, which was conducted by the maker of remdesivir called Gilead Sciences. He then went on in the same memo to declare that there is 2 drugs that were not allowed to be used because they found it had heart toxic effects leading to death in COVID-19 treated patients. And those 2 drugs were hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine. Now, I was not of interest of hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine at the time. I was most interested in this remdesivir drug because I had never heard of it. I also learned here that it was just an experimental drug. At this point, it was never FDA approved. So my curiosity was I wanted to know what Dr. Anthony Fauci was proclaiming on NIH.gov was his reasonings for choosing this one and only drug. So I clicked the first hyperlinked study to the New England Journal of Medicine on Ebola and then actually read the second study also. And Dr. Rainier, you understand this because we've done this interview before. I couldn't believe what I found out. So what I then learned was that remdesivir was not proven safe and effective against the Ebola virus. In fact, it was found to be the least effective and the deadliest drug in the trial. And the safety board for that trial suspended its use for the rest of the trial, and no one was allowed to get it because it had the only drug published in the trial of 4 drugs to have a percentage of death rate called mortality rate of over 50%. The other 3 drugs didn't have over a 50% mortality rate. Only remdesivir did. That's why the safety board pulled it. So this is the kind of information that I knew then Anthony Fauci was lying about this drug. The second study conducted by Gilead Sciences, they gave the drug remdesivir for 10 days to COVID-19 patients, 53 of them in March of 2020. Their reported conclusions were 31% of everyone they gave that drug to between days 5 and 10 of the treatment, and it was only for 10 days. They found 31% of everybody that got that drug who had COVID-19 positive. They actually experienced multiple organ failure, reported acute kidney failure, which is what all the media was reporting. And I knew right away that the doctors were being very honest in their reporting that they have never seen a respiratory virus in New York City. When they start treating this COVID-19 patients, they had never seen such amounts of acute kidney failure. And that's because they had never used the drug remdesivir before. They had no idea the drug they were pumping into them was causing acute kidney failure, liver failure, and heart failure, which are all now published side effects of remdesivir. The disappointing part of this for the entire world, I want you to know, Anthony Fauci said in May of 2020, he asked our federal government here in the United States to buy up all of the stock of this experimental drug, this failed drug, deadly drug, and he asked the federal government of the United States to export the drug to any other country until the end of 2020. This is significant because at the end of 2020 and now in February of 2022, America still has the highest death totals of all countries in the entire world for COVID-19 treatment. So all COVID-19 citizens in America, no other country has more deaths than we do. And I attribute it to the hospital protocols initiated early on by Dr. Anthony Fauci. And if you would let me present it, I'll show you all the evidence that supports my concern around this drug. Because right now, not only does the United States of America is the only country with over 900,000 dead COVID-19 citizens, Brazil's number two. And Brazil has over 630,000. And Brazil, since the beginning of March of 2021, is only using remdesivir in all of its hospitals. The correlation in publicized death side effects and deadly side effects of remdesivir, in my opinion, based on the data I can show you all, is that the hospital protocols, which includes remdesivir, and now 2 years later, its published combined side effects is the number one cause of death of all COVID-19 hospitalized individuals worldwide. Now, it's come to light also, and everyone needs to know this. From the beginning, I've heard the term, even from the judge, that this is a pandemic. From the beginning, not only in March and April of 2020, was the city of New York allowed to experiment on all New York patients with a drug called remdesivir to kill a whole bunch of them, causing acute kidney failure, secondary death by pulmonary edema, which is what happens when you cause acute kidney failure. Across the Atlantic Ocean in the UK, there's an organization called NICE, N-I-C-E, along with the UK Parliament, the MHRA. They all were supportive of what was called end-of-life care. And they put in this protocol to take in morphine and midazolam into the nursing homes of individuals all around the UK. And in March of 2020, they administered this drug in nursing homes and killed 18,000 people in March of 2020, 25,000 in April of 2020, but they called them all COVID-19 deaths. I believe remdesivir here in the United States, along with midazolam and morphine protocols called end-of-life care inside the UK, which everyone here should refer to, Claire Wills Harrison, she's an attorney out of the UK, has done a great job putting this together. John O'Looney's on this testifying group here. He can testify as a funeral director. The amount of deaths that were starting in March and April of 2020 only designated as COVID-19, even when none of these people had COVID-19 in March and April of 2020 in the UK. I believe there was a huge setup to mass murder a whole bunch of people using drugs and drug protocols that were governed, selected by federal health agencies and our governments to initiate a huge amount of death and then project on the world that there's a virus killing all these people. And I said from the beginning in May of 2020, they're going to use these death totals in hospitals and in nursing centers. They're going to call it death by a virus called COVID-19. They're going to take those numbers and they're going to sell the media and all of the societies of America and the UK that there's a deadly virus going around the world. And you need to sign up for our future vaccine program coming up, which we'll get into later in this trial. The vaccines by far was the end agenda. They had to mass murder a lot of people and convince them it was a deadly virus. Would you like me to present the evidence?
Please.
So Anthony Fauci declared that in May of 2020 that there was an Ebola trial in which remdesivir was found to be safe and effective against the Ebola virus. Did it? This is the actual trial. Still lives on the New England Journal of Medicine. You can see on the right-hand side of the page, it was published December 12, 2019. This study started in November of 2018. And this is what they did. They took four experimental drugs. All patients were given, you'll see the three names, ZMAP, which was a triple monoclonal antibody. You see an antiviral agent called remdesivir. a single monoclonal antibody called MAB114, and then a triple monoclonal antibody that the world knows about right now called Regeneron, abbreviated REGN-EB3. This was the actual study. We're going to go into four regions of Africa, and we're going to give four different drugs to Ebola patients. The conclusions, right off the bat, when you look at any study, they'll give you a summary, and then they'll show you the conclusions. This is very nefarious, and everyone needs to see this. Right off the bat, if you go in there right now, the conclusions were that both MAB114 and Regeneron were superior to ZMapp in reducing mortality from EBD, period. Now, I want to bring your attention to this. This is published on New England Journal of Medicine. Notice in the conclusion, they only list three drugs, but in the study, there were four drugs. It says both MAB and Regeneron were superior to ZMapp in reducing mortality from EBD. But they said there was four drugs in the study. Interesting, right? They didn't actually mention remdesivir. Well, let's find out why they didn't want to show this on the conclusions at the top of the study. All right, so just to bring everyone's attention here, if you look down in the parentheses here underneath conclusions, you'll see it's funded by the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. That's who funded this entire study on Ebola in Africa for the year 2018 to 19. Now, who's the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease? I just want to make sure for the world that it's on record. You can see the director of the NIH, NIAID department that funded the Ebola trial is Dr. Anthony Fauci. First statement is, Dr. Anthony Fauci was appointed director since 1984. So he would have been the same director during this 2018 to 19 study. How did they screen these people for Ebola? You just listened to Dr. Sonia. Now, all the patients in the Ebola trial, they used the PCR test to determine if they had Ebola. Disgustingly, they actually allowed pregnant women using the PCR test to designate positive results for Ebola. They allowed pregnant women, look at the last sentence highlighted, even neonates 7 days of age or younger were included in this experimental drug trial in Africa if the mother had documented positive Ebola. I find that pretty disgusting that an experimental drug trial you're going to put in 7-day-old and younger kids without symptoms. It just says if the mother tested positive. All right, now in the mortality section of this study on Ebola in Africa. On August 9, 2019, when 681 patients had been enrolled, the Data and Safety Monitoring Board conducted an interim analysis on data from 499 patients. And on the basis of two observations, in August of 2019, they recommended terminating random assignments to ZMapp and remdesivir. So the safety board saw two problems with ZMapp and remdesivir and terminated its use to be continued in this trial. Well, what was so disturbing? This is table two from that actual study. To get the group's eyes here and the audience's eyes here and the jury, table two, read the title, comparison of death at days 28 according to treatment group. You have the population column on the left. Then you'll have four drugs listed, ZMapp, remdesivir, MAB114, Regeneron is REGN-EB3. The first statistic listed under each one of those is for mortality rate. What is the percentage of people given that drug in this trial that died? ZMapp had a 49.7% death rate. You'll see it in parentheses just below ZMapp there in the highlighted area titled overall. So ZMapp, everyone that got the drug, 49.7% of them died. Remdesivir had a death percentage of 53.1%. MAB114, 35.1% of everyone died. Regeneron, 33.5%. Based on this information, the safety board saw that remdesivir had the highest mortality rate and was the least effective in the trial, and then decided to pull remdesivir and ZMapp from the trial. Now, for the jury, I would just like to present this to the jury. If you were Anthony Fauci and you had this one study that you funded and you were going to be selecting one drug and one drug only to be the only drug pumped into all innocent American citizens with COVID-19, would any of you knowing what the safety board knew when they pulled remdesivir, seeing it was the only drug that had a death rate of 53.1% or higher, which of these four drugs would you have chosen? And then I'd like you to ask yourself, why would Anthony Fauci have selected remdesivir? when the safety board had its own concerns. Which one would you have picked if these were the only four drugs you had in the entire world to pick from? I would like to hope and think that you, as a healthcare administrator or overseeing a department for the entire country, would make a decision to pick one with the least mortality rate, like Regeneron in this case. Just to bring your attention here, this is at the end of the study, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and then it lists the authors by abbreviation who actually contributed to the study. So after I saw this Ebola trial study, I knew Anthony Fauci was flat out lying. It was not proven safe and effective against the Ebola virus. That's what he said it did. Then I wanted to know, well, what did they find in the Gilead study? The Gilead study was done in March of 2020. You'll see it was published in June 11th. This was their own studies. This was done from January, just so you know, the Ebola trial published December of 2019. In that trial, remdesivir was pulled and found to be the least effective and the most deadly. Just a month later, January of 2020, Gilead is given the opportunity to do this study with remdesivir on COVID-19 patients. Now, the Ebola trial was 28 days of drugging for those drugs per patient. And they found more people died from remdesivir than any other drug. In this trial, in January of 2020, Gilead did something smart. They said, we're only going to give 10 days of this drug to COVID-19 patients. Why? Because 28 days worth killed the most people in the trial that just finished a month earlier. This is the published findings of Gilead from their 10 days of remdesivir poisoning in COVID-19 patients. 23% had serious adverse events between days 5 and 10. The most common serious adverse events, multiple organ failure, septic shock, acute kidney injury, and hypotension. Another 8% below there discontinued remdesivir treatment prematurely. They couldn't even make it the full days. One because of worsening pre-existing renal failure, one because of multiple organ failure, and two needed to have kidney transplants as a result of the drug killing their kidneys. Now, what was that being reported in the actual news? All I kept hearing was, we've never seen a virus cause acute kidney injury, when in fact 31% of the people who got remdesivir for 10 days were actually experiencing and reporting acute kidney failure from the Gilead trial just 2 months earlier. So at the same time that 10 days of remdesivir was getting pumped into the Gilead patients, 53 COVID-19 patients, there was a study at the exact same time in France, except France took remdesivir in January to March of 2020. They only gave it to five people, five COVID-19 positive patients, including one from Wuhan. And they gave the drug for 14 days. This is in the beginning of 2020. What did they find? This is what they did. So from, just want to show the dates, January 24th till March 1st, they were diagnosed with COVID-19 and treated with remdesivir from Gilead. This is who was enrolled. They're in Paris, France. What did they find? They actually had set up a 14-day duration of treatment with remdesivir. Highlighted part on the screen from the study, remdesivir was interrupted before the initial planned duration in four out of the five patients. Two, because of alanine aminotransferase elevations, which is increased liver toxicity enzymes in the blood work, abbreviated ALT on most blood panels. They said this number, liver toxicity, was 3 to 5 times the normal range within those 14 days. So they pulled those two patients off the drug early and then continue. And two, because of renal failure requiring renal replacement. Now, for the jury, renal means kidneys. So two of the four who came off had to be taken off because their kidneys died, requiring renal replacement. Before they were administered remdesivir, liver function and kidney function was tested, and they evaluated them every day as they received these drugs. Four out of the five patients had to come off early. Two of the five had to have kidney transplants as a result. Only one lived through the whole 14 days. Two out of the five died as a result of the treatment of remdesivir. There's a reason why France doesn't have the death totals that we do. Now, that was conducted in and finalized in March of 2020. Fast forward to November of 2020. Remdesivir, proclaimed by the World Health Organization, they determine and proclaim, read the highlighted part, the antiviral remdesivir should not be used as treatment for hospitalized COVID-19 patients. The World Health Organization said Thursday, only a month after the Food and Drug Administration approved the drug to treat patients over age 12 who are hospitalized. October 22nd, 2020 was the date in which the FDA in America approved remdesivir as an FDA-approved drug to treat COVID-19 patients. And the World Health Organization, just the next month, you'll see the date on there, November 19th, said, we do not recommend this based on all the data we've seen. Gilead reported in this information and data collection by the World Health Organization, Gilead even stated remdesivir has potential side effects on the kidneys that they reported to European Medicines Agency. This is November of 2020. For the jury and for the judge, I would like to present some information that's come probably the most disturbing out of this entire 2 years of studying these hospital protocols. This is published in Nature Medicine, July 10th, 2020. I want you to read the beginning part of this abstract. This is 2 months after Anthony Fauci gets Gilead, the maker of remdesivir, to be the only company, pharmaceutical company, awarded the only contract for the only drug to treat all COVID-19 hospitalized patients in the entire country of America. This summary here is titled, the title of this study is Extrapulmonary Manifestations of COVID-19. This means other than the lungs, what the virus does to the body and causing disease of other organs. Let's read the actual first sentence here. COVID-19 is most well known for causing substantial respiratory pathology or disease. It can also result in several extrapulmonary manifestations or disease processes outside the lungs. These conditions include thrombotic complications, that's blood clotting disorders, myocardial dysfunction, heart disease, and arrhythmia, acute coronary syndrome, which is strokes, heart attacks, acute kidney injury, GI symptoms, and hepatocellular injury. Hepatocellular means liver toxicity. Now, when I got this actual article, remember this is 2 months after Gilead Sciences is allowed to be the only drug manufacturer to provide a solution to all hospitalized patients for COVID-19. When I read this, I already knew that that the virus itself was not the primary cause of acute kidney injury. It was actually remdesivir and the liver toxicity, as mentioned here. But in Nature Medicine, July of 2020, there's this publication made for the whole world to be able to see this new novel virus is causing these issues in the body as doctors are treating it, so you know it's actually the virus and nothing else. All right, so here's what was reported in this study. In China, the reported incidence of acute kidney injury in hospital patients with COVID ranged from 0.5% to 29%, and it occurred with an average period of time within 7 to 14 days after being admitted in the hospital. So between weeks 1 and 2 of treatment is when acute kidney injury occurred. But studies from the USA have reported much higher rates of acute kidney injury in a study of nearly 5,500 patients admitted with COVID-19 in a New York City hospital system. Acute kidney injury occurred in 37%, with 14% of the patients requiring dialysis. Remember, they all said, we don't have enough dialysis machines here. And then read this. About one-third were diagnosed with acute kidney injury within 24 hours of admission in the study. The only drug being used in that study in New York City hospital systems in March and April of 2020 was remdesivir. That's the only thing different between what China was doing and what we were doing. I could not believe it. In the ethics declaration of this Nature Medicine publication about what the virus does for the entire world as doctors are treating them around the world, we want you to recognize the virus of SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, causes all these problems in other organs in the body. Inside the ethics declarations, where you actually have to list those who are contributing to the data in the study, you have to disclose, do you maybe have a conflict of interest in being allowed to participate in contributing data? I put on the screen for the jury. A woman named Joan, JMB, reports an honorarium for participation on a grants review panel for Gilead Biosciences. Why would someone on the payroll of Gilead be allowed to contribute when they're the only pharmaceutical company supplying the only drug to all COVID-19 hospitalized patients? Why would anyone on their payroll be allowed to contribute to designate and define what's the side effects of the virus you're treating when, in fact, I'll show you, this is actually all the side effects. All of these here, these side effects that are listed here, are actually side effects of remdesivir poisoning, and we can prove it. All right, so remdesivir, this is April 2021. There's actually a World Health Safety Database review. What they want to compare is around the world, which includes this audience, around the world, There are four major drugs being used to treat all COVID-19 patients. This is April 2021. They want to see if it's true that the virus causing COVID-19 is causing acute kidney injury in the majority of all people, and this is a side effect of the virus. We're going to look at the World Health Organization's database, and we're going to see, we're going to look at and compare four drugs treating COVID-19 patients worldwide: remdesivir, hydroxychloroquine, lopinavir, and a drug that's a monoclonal antibody called tocilizumab. And this is what they found. So this is the setup. Read the highlighted part. Reporting odds ratio compared the number of acute renal failure cases reported with remdesivir with those reported with other drugs prescribed in comparable situations of COVID-19. This is important. The most important part of this entire thing is they were prescribed these four drugs in comparable situations of COVID-19. Per the Nature Medicine publication, they said the virus causes acute kidney injury. They're going to compare and see, is it true that all these COVID-19 positive patients around the world are all developing acute kidney failure on an even scale? And we're going to look at all these patients being treated with four different drugs, hydroxychloroquine in parentheses, tocilizumab, and lopinavir. Well, what did they find? First sentence only. Reporting odds ratio of acute renal failure with remdesivir was 20-fold that of comparative drugs. 20-fold. Not even close. Remdesivir is known to cause acute kidney failure. Absolutely. Now, come full circle now to October of 2021, just 5 months later after April, and there's a journal called the Cardiovascular Toxicology Journal, titled Potential Cardiotoxic Effects of Remdesivir on Cardiovascular System. Read at the bottom. Remdesivir can also induce significant cytotoxic or cell toxic effects in cardiomyocytes, heart cells, that is considerably worse than chloroquine cardiotoxic effects. Remdesivir-induced toxicity is due to its binding of mitochondria and the RNA polymerase. I need to reread this. In May of 2020, Anthony Fauci said, you cannot use chloroquine, you cannot use hydroxychloroquine with these COVID-19 patients because chloroquine was found to cause heart disease and death in COVID-19-treated patients. So we're only going to use remdesivir. In October 2021, you can see the date at the top, the journal is to the left, Cardiovascular Toxicology. First sentence, remdesivir, in the highlighted part, remdesivir can also induce significant cytotoxic effects in cardiomyocytes that is considerably worse than chloroquine cardiotoxic effects. This is a study from 2020 early on that Anthony Fauci would quote saying chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine increase the risk of death in COVID-19 patients. And they said in this study, all four regimens were also independently associated with an increased risk of new onset ventricular tachycardia or fibrillation. So this study, they found there's toxic heart effects due to chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine that's increasing, read the title, the risk of death of COVID-19. However, the Cardiovascular Toxicology Journal just a few months ago, remdesivir far worse causes cardiotoxic effects as compared to chloroquine, as these studies proclaim. All right, what are some of the other published cardiotoxic effects? If you start here, there in the highlighted part, there are some reports of sinus bradycardia, hypotension, T-wave abnormalities, atrial fibrillation, which is arrhythmic issues. Remember, Nature Medicine said arrhythmias are the side effect of the virus. It's actually a known published side effect of the one and only drug getting pumped into your veins. And a prolonged QT interval, which is creating this lethargy and fatigue that everybody's experiencing. And few cases of cardiac arrest and complete heart block following remdesivir infusion. Why is this significant? In 2005, Anthony Fauci knew that chloroquine was found to be a potent inhibitor of SARS coronavirus, SARS-CoV-1, back in 2005. Why weren't we publishing this? The conclusion of this study in 2005, chloroquine, a relatively safe and effective and cheap drug used for treating many human diseases, including malaria, amoebiosis, and human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, is effective in inhibiting the infection and spread of SARS-CoV-1 in cell culture. We've known that for 15 years at this point. This is important. The NIH has just updated these charts. This is actually titled Table 2E on NIH.gov. Last updated July 8, 2021. You'll notice Remdesivir is listed here. You'll see adverse events is the second column. I want you, everyone's eyes to go to the fifth bullet point under adverse events for Remdesivir. It actually states that the drug vehicle is abbreviated SBECD, which has been associated with renal and liver toxicity. So we know it's even published as a known side effect of the drug. On this chart dated July 8, 2021, it was a broad titled characteristics, read the title, characteristics of antiviral agents that are approved or under evaluation for the treatment of COVID-19. On this chart, there was three drugs listed as either approved or under evaluation by the NIH. The second drug on that list was ivermectin. It gives you your doses of what to use in hospitalized patients. Very first bullet point in the second column under adverse events or side effects, generally well tolerated. Now, I want to bring everyone's attention to this because they updated this chart in December, and they call it now Table 2F. Look at the date, last updated December 16th, 2021, right underneath the title. They list Remdesivir. They also list Remdesivir as the only FDA-approved drug now on this list. But I want to bring your attention to ivermectin. You'll see ivermectin right underneath there. It says it's not approved by the FDA and not recommended by the panel. And I want you to notice what they deleted underneath side effects of ivermectin. I've been pointing this out to legislators around the country and around the world. They deleted the first one that said generally well tolerated. It's the only one they removed for reference. Check this out. Ivermectin, first bullet point, generally well tolerated. Now here. They removed it. They don't want you to see it. They don't want you to know it's generally well tolerated. All right. So I do want you to know there's like six or seven drugs on this chart now in the NIH. The actual drug Remdesivir is the only one now titled in December of 2021 and still now is the only FDA-approved drug to treat Remdesivir after it's been published that it causes liver failure, acute kidney failure, and now heart failure that we know and heart defects. Disgustingly, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services here in the United States, Medicare covers all the elderly, Medicaid's the impoverished and the disabled, but Medicare right now is actually offering, you'll see the title, new COVID-19 treatments add-on payments per the CARES Act. This should disgust everybody in the jury if it's true that Remdesivir causes acute kidney failure, liver failure, and heart failure. It should disgust everyone to find out that CMS for Medicare is bribing all hospitals with a 20% bonus payout if they'll just use Remdesivir. And that bonus payout goes for the entire bill for a COVID-19 treated patients. You'll read here in the highlighted part, NCTAP claims are those that are eligible for the 20% add-on bonus payment under the Section 3710 of the CARES Act. There's two things they're giving 20% bonuses for to all hospitals in America. For only Medicare-aged patients that's 65 years and older, two bullet points. ICD-10 CM diagnosis code of U07.1, that's COVID-19 positive. That's the diagnosis code they get a 20% bonus payout for. The second bullet point are ICD-10 PCS codes for Remdesivir. And then below there, you'll see the chart, and they actually tell the hospitals, if you'll just put down these two codes, those first two codes on the chart, we'll give you a 20% add-on bonus if you just pick Remdesivir, a drug known to be toxic and deadly, proven to be so. Now, I want to bring your attention to this. Why is Medicare continuing to bribe hospitals? Why? When in fact, look at this chart, look at the date top right. This is on c19early.com. This is today, February 13th, 2022. I want you to notice this is the all mortality result. They take research studies from around the world being used to treat hospitalized COVID-19 patients. And they want to know what of those drugs is producing the greatest rates of improvement and survivability. I want you to look at this chart. This is just as of this morning. Look at the bottom of the chart. That's where Remdesivir sits. The second column is the improvement section, the percentages of all people in the research studies that are seeing improvement and not dying. Remdesivir is at 19% improvement. And look at the amount of studies and the amount of patients in those studies, and then look at the cost of that failing drug. It's over $3,100 per treatment, which is a five-day treatment period. Almost everything above there has better results than Remdesivir, and this is worldwide studies. My question is, why are we still supporting a drug 2 years later that is obviously failing worse than 30-plus other products you can see here listed, which includes nutrients? You'll see ivermectin on here at 54% success rate by itself. that's easily double remdesivir's effectiveness at mortality and improving mortality outcomes. Quercetin, you'll see povidone iodines at 72%, and that's a nasal wash and throat gargle. That costs a dollar. Why are we promoting remdesivir? It's the most expensive drug on this entire list, and it's one of the most failed. The FDA has just updated, as of January 24th, just a few weeks ago, they updated that because of Omicron variant, we are now discontinuing to allow Regeneron to be used in all clinics around the country, all states, all territories, all jurisdictions. And they actually claim that Omicron is not found to react to the treatments from those monoclonal antibodies that have been being used. And because of this data, they're now suspending its use. I'm just showing you these things. There's only, they list here in the highlighted part, importantly, there are several other therapies, Paxlovid, Citrovimab, Remdesivir, which is called Veklury, and Molnupiravir, which is a Merck drug, that are expected to work against the Omicron variant. These are the only ones that are authorized or approved to treat patients with mild to moderate COVID-19 and outside of hospitals, actually, with Omicron variant. And I want to bring your attention back to this. They listed four drugs here, Paxlovid, Citrovimab, Veklury, Remdesivir, and Molnupiravir. Of everything on this chart I just showed you, Paxlovid's at the top. This is a drug created by Pfizer. It's only had one study, 2,000 patients. The average cost is $700. If you look at Citrovimab is down right above vitamin D. You'll see 41% and 46%. Citrovimab is what's the second drug that they suggest. Look at that. Two studies with 1,400 cases, $2,100. Molnupiravir is four above Citrovimab at 50% success rate. Three studies, 1,900 people, $700 a pop. I want you to just recognize these are the most expensive drugs on here, including Remdesivir was the fourth drug. There are so many other things that are cheaper and more effective, and people should be referencing this. 3 days before the FDA says now you have to use Remdesivir, Citrovimab, Paxlovid, and these other expensive drugs, Molnupiravir. 3 days before that, the world needs to know this. The jury needs to know it. This drug that causes acute kidney failure, liver failure, and heart failure, it was just increased by the FDA January 21st. I'll read this to you. Fact sheet for healthcare providers. EUA, emergency use authorization of Veklury Remdesivir for the treatment of coronavirus 2019 in pediatric patients weighing 3.5 kilograms. They are now authorizing Remdesivir to be pumped into the veins of all newborns weighing 7 pounds or more and anyone in between. And they are PCR testing babies in hospitals as soon as they're born, looking to see if they test positive with a PCR test, and they will take them and inject them intravenously with Remdesivir, a proven drug that kills heart cells called cardiomyocytes, liver failure, and kidney failure. I need to bring some things to the attention of the jury, the judge, and the world in relationship to this judge. I mean, to this document. It states testing who are positive in hospitals or non-hospitals. So this is in and out of hospitals. What every person needs to know is on this emergency use authorization by the FDA for pediatrics only. First bullet point here, the parent, giver, and caregiver has the option to accept or refuse Veklury. Please pay attention to that. All parents, you have the right to refuse per the EUA. Third bullet point, information on available alternative treatments and the risk of the benefits of those alternatives have to be told by the healthcare professional. They have to tell you the alternative treatments that are available for your kid or your baby. I need to show you what's in the document, though. Look at this. It actually states, hold on, let me show you. Approved available alternatives. Look in the middle of the page. Approved and available alternatives. This is on page 10 of the same document. Notice it reads, there is no approved available alternative product for the treatment of COVID-19 in pediatric patients. Now, wait a minute. They just said at third bullet point here, the doctors and healthcare providers have to provide information on available alternative treatments. But later in the document, they tell you there is no other ones that are approved, only Remdesivir. It actually states here what they have to do if they ever give you Remdesivir and there's a side effect. Look at statement 7. It actually says within 7 calendar days, a healthcare provider has to actually publish on a U.S. FDA form titled 350, all serious adverse events reported in babies receiving Remdesivir. The world needs to know this. What's the serious adverse events that could happen from remdesivir that they want you to report and are holding you liable for? Look here. Under number 8, look at the asterisk. Serious adverse events are defined as death, a life-threatening adverse event, inpatient hospitalization or prolonging of existing hospitalization, a congenital anomaly or birth defect, a persistent or significant incapacity or substantial disruption of the ability to conduct normal life functions. A medical, last one bullet point, a medical or surgical intervention to prevent death, a life-threatening event. All right, what else do you need to know? At the bottom of the screen, I want you guys to know why the EUA was given by the FDA for the use of remdesivir in babies. It says here at the bottom, FDA has issued this EUA requested by Gilead, the maker of remdesivir, and based on their data submitted. Okay, now, I just want to bring something up here. Why aren't we having the other companies that make ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, budesonide? They need to approach the FDA and just ask for an EUA to be able to be allowed, because it looks like Gilead could do it. And based on their submitted data, I want to show you what the data is that's in this document. So let's look at the data that Gilead gave to the FDA to say, you know what, we can use this in pediatric patients now. This is at 11.3. So all data for pediatric use. Look at this. The safety and effectiveness of Veklury, remdesivir, have not been established in pediatric patients weighing 3.5 kilograms to less than 40 kilograms. For those who are either bullet points, hospitalized or not hospitalized. So I'd like to know what data the FDA had. If it hasn't been proven safe and effective with the pediatric patients, what data did Gilead give you? When in fact, remdesivir is still proven to be the least effective and most dangerous of almost every one of these drugs that you see on this list. I confer to the jury to find out why are they actually using this drug and continue to use this drug when in fact it is proven to cause more mortality, death, and side effects than many more drugs.
That the slide again, because I think in the footprint it said it's being extrapolated to something from the information that we received from studies from the adults, but I mean these were negative, so
yeah, that's right. Here, I'll share it with you again. Yes, hold on. And what's amazing to me is all the documentation about remdesivir and its failed publications and studies. You can see it there on the screen. Use in this age group is based on extrapolation of pediatric efficacy from adequate and well-controlled studies in adults. And I am going to share something with you so the world can see this, because they need to see it. This is the NIH table 2F that I keep showing you. This was just updated December. Let's leave it a pull up here for us. This is table 2F. I just need to show you and scroll through this. It lists here remdesivir approved for the FDA treatment of COVID-19 hospitalized patients. Approved by the FDA. I'm going to scroll through here so you can see the lists. Interferon alpha now is added to it. Not approved. Interferon beta. Not approved. Interferon lambda. Not approved. Come down here, ivermectin. Not approved. However you pronounce this one, not approved. And then you come to the end. There is no other drugs the NIH and Anthony Fauci are saying are allowed or approved for treatment. Yet it discloses here that it causes acute renal failure. I don't know if you noticed this here, but this monitoring parameters, remdesivir, it says see remdesivir section for information on using remdesivir in people with renal insufficiency. The monitoring parameters here lists that it's okay that if we give someone remdesivir in America, you can actually watch the liver enzyme activities right here, ALT and AST elevation. They say if you see ALT going up like they found in the France study, the French study, they pulled remdesivir when their liver ALT numbers went up 3 to 5 times normal. They considered that toxic and deadly. Do you know what America and the NIH says is acceptable levels of ALT elevations? It's in the remdesivir's EUA. They allow your liver toxicity enzymes to go up ALT to 10 times the normal range. That's acceptable. And for those of you who want to see it, I'll show it to you because it's in there and it's disgusting to me. Let's show you. I have so much documentation here, but I want to show you, just so you can see. Here we go. It's right here. I already found it. Okay. World needs to see. Why did it bother France and they pulled it off of there? Increased risk on page 7 of the EUA for remdesivir. Increased risk of transaminase elevations. And I want you to go below to the bottom. Look at the first bullet point at the bottom. It says right above there, perform liver laboratory testing in all patients before starting remdesivir and during treatment. First bullet point. Consider discontinuing remdesivir if ALT levels increase to greater than 10 times the upper limit of normal. I would like to know why our NIH is okay with intoxicating a liver that the French scientist doctors pulled the drug knowing that it was deadly and toxic to inflame a liver to have 3 to 5 times the normal levels of ALT, and they consider that life-threatening. Why does our NIH, Anthony Fauci, and these protocols, why are they okay giving this drug to them? Oh, and I need to show you the next one. Can I show you the next one? Right underneath this 10 times accepted level for ALT elevations, liver toxicity, it actually states here, I need to show you. Hold on. I want to know what I was going to show you. Sorry about that. All right, so here you'll see, though, right below it says risk of reduced antiviral activity with co-administered chloroquine phosphate or hydroxychloroquine sulfate. I need you to know. Oh, I know what I wanted to show you. Hold on. Let me show you. I have to show you. Oh, please. Give me just a second, jury. You got to see this. Right here. This is what I was trying to get to. All right. This says these things are required. Okay. Number 4, like you mentioned, I showed you a second ago, you have to perform hepatic laboratory testing in all patients before starting Veklury. Number 5, you have to determine prothrombin time in all patients before starting Veklury and monitor during treatment as clinically appropriate. I'm not sure if you guys know what prothrombin time is. But prothrombin time, by definition, this is a clotting factor for blood. If prothrombin time is going up, it means it's taking longer for your blood to clot and you will have internal bleeding. If prothrombin time is being shortened, that means you're actually getting blood clot issues. So this drug, they know, there's 2 things. You have to check liver functions before and during treatment, supposedly, per the EUA. You have to determine blood clotting time before and during treatment. And I would like to know if everyone around the world is doing this at all. And I would demand that all healthcare professionals do this because this drug is proven to cause cardiovascular toxic effects, including, as we showed you in the Nature Medicine, they said thrombotic events, blood clotting events occur due to the virus, when in fact, remember, Gilead was allowed to participate in contributing their published side effects of the drug. This drug needs to be taken out of circulation. There's a lot more information on this drug, a lot more things that we have here, but this drug by far, I believe, has been used just like the sedative drugs, and this is not the only one. Remdesivir is targeting and killing the elderly. It's complicating issues of liver failure, kidney failure, and heart failure. But there are sedation drugs being used around the world, like midazolam, morphine, currently in America and in Canada. They're using drugs like this to intubate these people who are being forced into having multiple organ failure, requiring them to go onto a vent because they can't breathe. And these drugs are midazolam, morphine, lorazepam, Presidex. And these drugs suppress the nervous system's ability to control your ability to breathe. They are respiratory suppressive. They're also known to paralyze the central nervous system and stop the heart from beating. It is my opinion they're using these as euthanizing agents and protocols to speed up the actual death processes in hospitals. And they're targeting the elderly around the world and did from the beginning. And we actually absolutely see that they are now targeting the young and now all people. And if of interest, if you don't mind, can I show you one more thing? They are targeting the hearts of all these people with these drugs for sedation and with remdesivir as proven in those studies. There's one other thing I would love to show the world before it even comes up. I may not even be a part of it. But in the Circulation Journal, here we go. You just have to understand, I believe there's an asserted attack on heart muscle using remdesivir, using spike proteins, and using the vaccines. You have to just see this because it goes right in along lines of what remdesivir is proven to do. The American Heart Association publishes a journal called Circulation. In November 8th, you'll see the date right there, originally published November 8th, 2021. It's titled mRNA COVID Vaccines Dramatically Increase Endothelial Inflammation Markers and Acute Coronary Syndrome Risk as Measured by the Pulse Cardiac Test. This is a warning, and this is what they found at the bottom. At the time of this report, the changes to the heart persist for at least 2.5 months after the second dose of the mRNA vaccines. We conclude that the mRNA vaccines dramatically increase inflammation on the endothelium and the T-cell infiltration of cardiac muscle, and may account for the observations of increased thrombosis, blood clot disorders, cardiomyopathy, and other vascular events following the vaccine. This is a warning. I only bring this up not because this is the part of the jury trial where you're being taught about the side effects of the vaccines. You have to understand they are finding now that the targeted ingredients in the vaccines are targeting heart muscles, the blood clotting issues within the heart. They're causing strokes, heart attacks, and the American Heart Association is publishing this in November. This is a month after the Cardiovascular Toxicology Journal published that remdesivir causes thrombotic issues, cardiomyopathy, and death of heart cells. I believe there's an onslaught attack to create targeted drug therapies or poisons that are directly targeting the heart of individuals, innocent people around the world. And they are calling it COVID-19 death using falsified testing like PCR that we've already learned about here. And that is my argument. When in fact, we know there's currently 150 studies promoting that natural immunity and showing that natural immunity post-infections from COVID or anything else are actually showing robust and longer lasting immunity than any of the current vaccines that are actually being pushed on the public at large.
Can I ask if there's evidence of any conflict of interest or like financial interests involved of maybe Fauci in what's going on?
Yeah, so there was actually a meeting. I won't pull up here. I can't pull up here. But there's a meeting where Anthony Fauci met with 11 different people in discussing which drugs they were going to use as the solution for the pandemic. And this was in March. Peter Bregan did a great job in his book of noting this, in his book subtitled We Are the Prey. Dr. Peter Bregan, there was a meeting, Anthony Fauci and 17 other representatives, 9 of them were in this meeting, and they all worked at Gilead Sciences. Isn't that amazing? That's who he chose as his group of individuals to select for remdesivir. So that's a great resource, 2,000 citations in his book about that. I also will tell you, there is connections to Anthony Fauci, Gilead Sciences. I've already heard references in this trial today. People need to look into Gilead Sciences' connections to Genentech and Roche, and PacBio, who's creating these PCR tests. There's a lot of collusion behind a lot of what they've done from the beginning, and it's been orchestrated since 2014-15. It's a part of this entire pandemic. But yes, there's, and I will tell you, with Anthony Fauci and with the corporations that own Gilead, it's primarily owned by corporations such as Vanguard and BlackRock. There's tons of connections to Gilead, Anthony Fauci, and others. So the selection still, the support still of using remdesivir, in my mind, is still to target the hearts, livers, kidneys of individuals. They know it's toxic. The reason why I believe they are right now putting remdesivir as of January 21st with the EUA as the only drug authorized to be pumped into the veins of all children, and there's no other alternatives, is they need babies to start dying because February 15th was the FDA meeting that was supposed to be happening to vote to give these vaccines to newborns, to five-year-olds, the Pfizer shots. So I believe they are actually setting this up one step after another, in lockstep, to create more carnage, more death, more trauma, blaming it on a virus that, like this Omicron variant that is almost the common cold, and I would argue it actually is the common cold, personally. But they want to actually project that this is deadly even in pediatric demographics so they can sell parents, grandparents, that they need to get the vaccines as well. And that's the only reason why they would do it. I can't find any other reason why you would do it. Even when I showed you the mortality results document from C19early.com updated daily, you see remdesivir's effectiveness at actually preserving the lives of people with COVID-19. It's 19% from research studies worldwide. 2 years later, 19%. I would like to ask the jury, why are we still promoting this one and only drug? It's now actually authorized to be used in all nursing homes in America, by the way, outside of hospitals, as of the January 24th FDA update. So just like midazolam, morphine being used in the UK to kill innocent elderly people there, call it COVID-19, they are now setting the stage to do it here with a drug called remdesivir. And with the published documentation I gave you, there's no reason on the planet I would consider it safe to be given to the elderly. When in fact, right now, February 13, 2022, there's less than 1% of the entire world that's gotten this virus and been infected with it who has died. Less than 1%. In the state of New York, we pulled CMS data with attorney Thomas Renz and his CMS whistleblowers. The entire state of New York alone, every Medicare patient who has received 5 days of remdesivir treatment for COVID-19 in the state of New York, the entire mortality rate is 26.9% of all of them died. When I say they're targeting the elderly, they know these drugs are going to be toxic to them. And so anyway, these numbers are disturbing. Why would you use a drug that's failed at this extent, continued on 2 years later, unless there's a attempt and a plan of genocide to then sell the massive amounts of public around the world that you need our vaccines, which are obviously failing, and you'll go into that further into the trial.
Is this an only prescription-only drug, or can you use can you self-administer this drug as well? And do
remdesivir
people do that?
Only approved to be given, yeah, remdesivir is only approved to be given intravenously, and it has to be done either by a hospital or somebody in a nursing home. Right? They administer it through an IV needle. It is not through a tablet now. It's also been approved to be used now at infusion centers that are outside of hospitals for outpatient, where they were using monoclonal antibodies like Regeneron that were very successful. They're now allowing remdesivir to be used in those facilities. Those are intravenous also.
Now, at the risk of making a fool of myself, is it a fair conclusion after looking at everything, all the evidence that we have heard tonight, including your own evidence, is it a fair conclusion to say that, one, we only have an illusion of a pandemic that was created by a faulty PCR test? Two, they're using this illusion in order to use drugs that kill people, which is then, three, the reason for making people believe that this is caused by the virus, the illusion, and then, four, use vaccines that are just as deadly as remdesivir and the other drugs.
The illusions, is absolutely the illusions. However, the corruption cannot be understated. Dr. Pierre Corey, he continues to say, this is a nonstop, obvious, corrupt attempt to create death and harm. The PCR tests do not determine if you have SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 or any respiratory virus for that matter. It's a faulty test, faulty cycle set up for it to create and exaggerate cases of COVID-19. In March of 2020, our CDC published documents to hospitals around the country. Thomas Renz filed a lawsuit. They actually said, in March of 2020, all hospitals, if a patient comes in and you test them positive for influenza A or B, but they test negative for pneumonia and negative for the PCR test of COVID-19, this is in their own documents. If you'll look at the intake form and look at their home address, if it's in a city where in the media you have heard there are positive cases of COVID-19, you can call this case a positive COVID-19 case, document it as such, and we'll give you a 20% additional bonus for that diagnosis instead of the actually tested confirmed flu diagnosis. And then they did the same thing for pneumonia. So beginning March of 2020, they started incentivizing hospitals and clinicians to give diagnoses of COVID-19 that were false, even if they didn't test positive for PCR, and they incentivized them all to do it. So yes, it is an illusion orchestrated by our federal health agencies to exaggerate the cases of COVID, to exaggerate the causes of death from COVID, and they're calling them complications of COVID, and I would definitely call on as many plaintiffs as possible of loved ones who have died in hospitals around the world who were treated with remdesivir. I have actually encouraged, asked for, and have had and received thousands of these from around the world. and I asked them to look at their certificates, their death certificates, you will see they died of complications of COVID-19. They diagnosed secondly from acute kidney failure, and they died from complications of secondary COVID pneumonia. It is not secondary COVID pneumonia. When you shut down the kidneys and you put a IV bag flooding water into the veins of someone and they can't excrete the water from their kidneys you've shut down, you flood their abdomen with water. It then floods inside the heart, and then it infiltrates your lungs, and you drown them to death. It's called pulmonary edema. So I call on everybody to drive as many of these people in to actually give this information. We know this is what the drugs do. Yes, there's an illusion that they're dying from a virus. They're being poisoned to death with ill-advised protocols. Absolutely. They're also being asked and incentivized to artificially exaggerate positive cases and give diagnoses for it. I just showed you that Medicare in America is incentivizing hospitals with a 20% bonus and the code if you'll just give us a positive COVID-19 diagnosis for all Medicare-age patients. Really. And I would like to ask you, jury, judge, if, like I showed you on the NIH chart, that there's only one drug as of December 16th that's FDA approved for treating COVID-19 hospitalized patients, why is Medicare bribing all the hospitals to use that one and only drug if there's only one approved to be used anyway? Why would Medicare have to bribe them with a 20% bonus payout to use the one and only one? There can only be a nefarious reason behind why they're bribing all hospitals to use that one drug proven to cause acute kidney failure, liver failure, and heart failure. From the beginning, we knew that was the case. You have all been lied to.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah. Dr. Ardis, thank you so much for your evidence. I must say that you have put the jury in picture exactly as to what we are dealing with. And what we are dealing with is a textbook scenario when it comes to medical malpractice. And we see it not just only in the United States, but we see it in each and every country of the world. And having regard to this grand jury as well, you can quickly just tell us, or you can basically just say as to whether you confirm that each and every hospital, each and every medical doctor that prescribe remdesivir, that prescribe all the other medicine that you have mentioned, mendesalem as well also, yeah, if I actually pronounce that correctly, that they are practicing that malpractice, medical malpractice, without a shadow of a doubt. Will you agree with that? And that is basically in line with your statement and your evidence that you have just given, that you actually motivate each and every citizen, the jury in a matter of fact, throughout the world, that once they can get or they realize that those drugs has been prescribed, that they actually need to take the necessary action. So are we now really, and for me, based on the evidence that you have given, this is a textbook scenario of medical malpractice, and at the heart of this medical malpractice, without a shadow of a doubt, it is financial gain. And the parties that you've mentioned when it comes to financial gain is BlackRock, and I believe that all of the other investors as well also. So will you agree that, yes, we are now talking about a textbook scenario when it comes to this medicine that's being prescribed, and it is also then used at the same time to increase the statistics, and it is used at the same time as well also to inculcate or basically instill fear in the populace of the world. Will you agree with that?
Absolutely, 100%. I confirm that. Also, I would just like to say this is actually textbook eugenics.
I think you are absolutely right, because the thing is like when we look at intention, and you have made the intention quite clear, the way as to how you've actually taken the jury through each and every of the documentation, for me, it also comes down to eugenics. It comes down to clear criminal intent. And I do not see as to how any of these culprits will be able to actually get off it itself. So thank you for making that clear. Thank you so much for your evidence. And thank you for taking the time, step by step, showing the jury, showing each and every citizen in the world as to what we are currently dealing with. Thank you, Dr. Ardis.
You're very welcome. And I cannot say thank you enough to Dr. Renier Fulmick and your team. And thank you for all of you that are here, for standing for humanity when so many obviously don't care and do not want to do the right thing. So thank you, every single one of you. It was my intent from the beginning to try to educate, warn, and inspire as many people as possible to what was going on. And you guys have done a great job of putting together a great group of people that I continue to call my colleagues and my friends. Thank you on behalf of humanity.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
We do care. All of us care. Before we now turn to Dr. Shankara Chetty, please, John O'Looney, I think even though it's extremely troubling, but I think this is the right time for you to explain what happened in the UK, because it sort of mirrors what Dr. Brian Artis just told us. What happened in the UK, and how did you find out about it?
You're mute.
There you go.
Thank
you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Cool. So as a funeral director, initially, obviously, when COVID first appeared, I was convinced I had no reason not to be, and certainly wouldn't have suspected that it was going to be such a nefarious, plandemic is the word that's been used to describe it. There were a number of things that kind of raised the alarm for me. One was the death rate across 2020, despite the best efforts made during a period of March and April in care homes. There was no increase in death rate. There was, we were seeing one thing on the news and we were being told about this deadly pandemic and people falling over left, right and center, and it just wasn't there. The death rate wasn't there. I was washing and dressing people that were alleged COVID victims throughout 2020, and it's very interesting to hear the doctor talk about the edema on the lungs, because when we embalm someone, the process is quite invasive, and there's an instrument called a trocar that's inserted into people, into their abdomen and into their lungs, and we were pulling loads of edema from patients who'd come into our care, and it was so obvious, like a yellow clear fluid as we emptied the lungs kind of thing. They were consistently full. I also had a pandemic guy. He introduced himself as John. His name was John. He called me early in 2020. He told me he was a government sponsored pandemic guy. He said that he would be calling all of the funeral directors in the local area, and his task was to collate COVID deaths and numbers. He asked me what my capacity as a funeral director was, how many deceased could I hold in my facility. He asked me how many deceased I'd collected that week and how many were COVID and where from. So it wasn't too long, virtually straight away, he started steering me. And by that, I mean, he would say, I would tell him, for example, I collected a gentleman from a care home. He had onset dementia. I've spoken to the family. He'd been in there 4 years. There were no doctor present at the time of his death. There was no COVID test present at the time of his death. And yet this guy would insist that they were all COVID deaths. And when I kind of questioned that, he would say, we've been told there was COVID in that facility, in that care home, so we've been instructed we have to label them all as COVID deaths. These people didn't have COVID. This was the same scenario was happening with cancer patients. Basically, anyone they could label as a COVID death, and they thought they could get away with it, that's what they were doing. Even one guy that was run over, he had tire marks from his hip to his chest. He was a COVID death, this happened throughout 2020, and great effort was made to do that. And then shortly before the end of 2020, when it was announced that the injections were coming and everybody wanted one then, because there were so many COVID deaths, he rang and told me he wouldn't be calling anymore. So clearly the need isn't there anymore for this pandemic guy to call me. So it was obvious, what he was doing. And I kind of, towards the end of 2020, I realized what was going on. And it obviously is very troubling. I've got these people coming to, and it's hard being a funeral director anyway, when you're dealing with a number of tragic deaths anyway. But when you're dealing with people that are unlawfully killed, it's even more heartbreaking. Some of the families are blissfully unaware. Some of the families are very aware, and no one's listening to them. you know, since going public, I've had a large number of people reach out to me, people from within the NHS environment who have whistleblown to me, victims who have recounted their story. And I've also been in the unique position of being in the hospital as a COVID patient to see things firsthand. And I, you know, as ill as I was, I looked at that as an opportunity to get as much information and, you know, gather as much evidence as I could while I was in there. And it was very productive, I can tell you. So 2020 came and went, and I kind of, locally where I am, they announced they were going to begin vaccinating on the 6th of January 2021. And I kind of had an idea then. In fact, I mentioned to a number of people, I suspected the death rate would finally soar, because it hadn't. The moment they put needles in arms, and it did, it went through the roof. I would say around 300% the normal death rate from the point they put needles in arms. It was horrific. It was horrific. That was the only time during the period, this whole two-year period, that I would call that a pandemic death rate as an undertaker. And that lasted more or less 12 weeks before it's almost like somebody stopped. They'd run out of that batch. You know, it kind of stopped altogether, and it went very, very quiet. And then what we see now is we're seeing a number of people coming through who are dying from thrombosis, that being aneurysm, stroke, or heart attack. And more troubling, these are people of all ages. So the youngest that I've looked after are 23, 28, 32, 33, people that just don't usually die from thrombosis. You know, and great numbers of them, large numbers. In fact, one of the calls, there's a few key calls that I've taken from people who have reached out to me. One of them was a mortuary manager called Nick, who works in a large hospital. He's been there nearly 30 years. He was due to lose his job in April because they were blackmailing people, you know, if they don't take the jab, no job. Hopefully he's had that rescinded now because they've backtracked. They don't want 80,000 key witnesses, do they? He said to me, he collates the numbers. Now, I have to be careful because of GDPR, these laws they passed recently, there's, you know, only so much info I can keep. But as a mortuary manager, he collates this information, and he told me he's seen a 600% increase this year in thrombosis deaths exclusively in jab recipients. Now, that would very much collate with what I've seen. I've seen more thrombosis deaths this year. And I mean, when I worked for a big players, like I worked for a Cooperative Funeral Care, which has a 60% market share in the UK of the funeral industry, very big player. I rarely ever saw people in their 20s, you know, coming into our care, even with those. I've seen low more this year than I've ever seen. And they've all been sudden deaths. And, you know, you kind of cast your mind to the look at the number of footballers, super fit sportsmen that have suddenly dropped down dead on national TV from heart problems. You know, it's unprecedented, and nobody seems to want to acknowledge that. So I was so concerned that I actually wrote to the Chief Coroner of England, because my job as a funeral director is to raise concerns if I have concerns about a death or deaths. As such, I CC'd in many of the people, some of them in this room, Dolores included, and kind of said, look, I know you're aware of these deaths, this large increase in thrombosis deaths. What's happening? I never got any reply. I left it 3 or 4 weeks and then emailed again and finally got a reply from the secretary that said, we follow government policy. So they are correctly diagnosing these deaths as thrombosis deaths. And quite often these people come in and they're cut from the ankle to the hip, where they've been looking for the thrombosis down the ephemeral artery and places like that, I assume. But they're not going any further than that to actually link it to a jab they had perhaps 2 weeks before. Or even in one case, I had a 28-year-old in who died 90 minutes after being vaccinated in the same hospital bed she was in. And her parents are obviously furious. And nobody wants to know. You know, they've said, well, it's a thrombosis death. You know, is it unheard of? No. But is it as common as it's happening? And is it just after a gene therapy injection? No, it is. So the story with this girl is, and I can tell you her family won't mind me telling you, she was admitted into hospital for a minor procedure. They coerced her in there by telling her she was at great risk because there were COVID patients in there, and she reluctantly took a vaccine and died 90 minutes later in the hospital bed from thrombosis. You know, so it's quite obvious what's killed that young girl, and indeed she came in cut from ankle to hip, where they've been searching for these thrombosis. So just before Christmas of 2022, just before this Christmas, I was taken ill, had a cold, it kind of developed. My missus had it as well. We were both went to bed, you know, because we felt that unwell. And I started getting a bit breathless. So I had an ambulance turn up. It consisted of three staff members, two big guys who were really nice, and a woman who began berating me almost instantly, saying how selfish I was. And this is a story that I've heard from multiple people where they do this. They start berating you for your choices medically. Anyway, they took me to hospital. I went to triage initially, and they did three lateral flow tests there and then. They all were negative. I was then transferred onto one of the wards in the morning, this was early hours of the morning, I had a consultant come round. He sat on the bed and he said, right, we're going to start you on remdesivir. And I kind of said, thank you, but no, thank you. And he, well, why, you know? And I kind of said, well, because let's have a look at the clinical reasoning behind that then. And he stomped off. He didn't even want to engage with me on any level. He knew what I was talking about. I had a couple of staff members in there come over to me and quietly thank me for what I was doing. You know, that's not exchanging pleasantries. These people know what's going on. That afternoon, I had a young lady approach my bedside. She sat on the edge of the bed. She offered me, she said, I'm, whatever her name was, from Oxford University. Okay, so this is unusual. You know, this is not normal practice in a hospital. So she said, I'm here to offer you a couple of trial drugs. We're trying to save lives. I feel you might die without them. She told me that. And one of them was baricitinib, and the other one was toxilizumab. So again, I took the names of these drugs, and I said, well, let's just have a think about this. Can you give me the spellings? And I, you know, a basic Google search for side effects tells you what you need to know. And I kind of said, why would you consider giving this to someone with respiratory problems? You know, and she again couldn't look me in the eye, was looking everywhere but at me, and was like a girl, a child who'd been caught with a hand in the biscuit tin. You know, she left the bedside, said, well, I'll come back tomorrow then, you know. And the two guys that were opposite me were COVID patients, had both accepted these treatments. And I lay awake all night listening to these guys on CPAP, high pressure ventilation, coughing and spluttering, and every now and again, the nurse would come out and feed one of them morphine, you know, which again, I felt was really, really wrong. You know, I'm an undertaker, I'm not a doctor, but I'm sensible enough and educated enough to know that this is not treatment conducive to recovery. And I heard these guys coughing and spluttering and dying, you know, and it became apparent then, you know, I knew I had to get out because they knew who I was, you know, and for them to offer me three of the most toxic drugs ever, when my stats are reading 78%, you know, it was, I'd been on a couple of days of antibiotics and steroids, and I'd recovered enough where I kind of tried to discharge myself, and there ensued a three-hour battle where they wouldn't let me out. You know, they even called security on me and said that they would have me arrested as a threat to public health. And, you know, it was ridiculous. 3 hours of arguing, and in the end, they kind of knew they'd never had a leg to stand on, and I was going to be persistent. They rang my wife, a guy called, I've got his name, and a recording of the conversation. And he was a respiratory consultant, and he told my wife, John will die if he leaves the ward in minutes, you know, in an attempt to keep me in there and finish me off. I know that's what it was. I'm not stupid. It was really chilling. It was really chilling. And when I left the hospital, actually, I was very fortunate, and I've made some really good friends. I was going to say contacts, but they're more than that now. Friends, you know, and they came to the hospital. Mark Sexton came, and a guy called Dr. Chan, and they saved me. You know, they helped facilitate me being released from custody, you know, which is the reality of what it was. And, you know, I didn't need oxygen. They were giving me oxygen that I didn't need. They were desperately trying to get me to go on CPAP. Even in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, they were trying to ventilate me, to persuade me ventilation was the way forward when I got to hospital, and I kind of said no. And you know, it's I actually felt traumatized because I knew what was going on, and there's nothing worse than going into hospital and you're unwell, and I was unwell, and there are people in there that you're supposed to be able to trust who are trying to kill you, you know, and that's the reality of what it was. And I've got a really good friend whose mum I looked after, who went through exactly the same experience, almost word for word, where, you know, she was they were abusive in the ambulance. She had a negative test there. They were then trying to coerce her into take the same drugs, and she eventually released herself. And they're pretty quick to discharge you when they realize you're not going to take these drugs, you know. But with me, they tried to hold on to me. They were actually quite intimidating and aggressive, and it's only for the fact that I'm actually quite a strong character, and I'm well up on what these drugs do and what the aim is, that I survived, to be honest with you, because I like I say, I watched these two guys opposite me dying, who trusted them, and it was chilling. The whole thing was awful, to be honest with you, and I've certainly no desire to ever go back in there again. I can tell you, I'd rather die at home, I think. And that's kind of where we are. So I've been back at work about 4 weeks now, and I've pretty much recovered quite well. You know, they kind of the advocates that I had or that I have have kind of guided me with ivermectin and the various tablets. To be honest with you, one of the hardest things to cope with was the brain fog, and so they even this Dr. Chan did a spreadsheet for me with what I should take when, and my missus put it all in, and I have little pots for morning, noon, and night, and I've been looked after. I'm very fortunate, and I kind of, when I left the hospital, I had survivor's guilt, because it's very much like leaving a burning house. You know, there are people still in there who are going to die, and I couldn't do anything for them, and it's going to haunt me forever that I couldn't save them, you know, and that's kind of where I am.
It sounds like a horror movie, what you're describing, but it's reality.
It was a horror movie. It was awful. I'm quite strong-willed, but I do feel that it did affect me mentally, the distress of it. And I stayed awake 72 hours. I was too frightened to go to sleep, just in case one of them put something in me, you know. You'll never understand unless you're in that position and you're isolated, and they won't let any family in or advocates to support you. And then I had to fight for 3 hours, gasping for breath to get out, knowing that if I didn't, I would probably die. Yeah, it was awful. It was bloody awful.
My God. From what you've seen, the conclusion that you can draw after hearing all this testimony, is it that you too believe that this is intentional mass murder that's being committed?
100%, definitely. Not at staff level. Some of the staff, and I looked at it as an opportunity while I was in there to gather evidence. So some of the staff have detached themselves. Other staff are aware of what's going on, and they've bought into it, thinking it's right because they're doing what they're told to do. Other staff are broken. I mean, I've spoke to nurses who tell me they go into work to try and minimize the damage being done by the clinical decision being made. They've cried down the phone. You know, I've spoken to one girl in particular, a girl called Michelle. She'd done 30 years as a nurse. Really, really eloquent. It was chilling testimony. I listened to her for about 40 minutes in a phone call she made to me just before I was taken ill. And she said what they were doing, they were taking people into hospital, giving them a chest x-ray in the bed with a mobile machine they take around. And I actually got x-rayed myself by this machine, so I kind of know what she means. And on the basis of that x-ray, they were putting them on palliative care. They weren't even doing any tests at all. And in some cases, locking them in a side room. You know, when you talk about someone who's geriatric, you know, quite elderly, they've got no hope of surviving that. You know, she said she's going to be forever haunted by an old man banging on the door of his side room, which was locked. begging for a cup of tea that she was unable to give him because the doctors wouldn't let, you know, it was nil by mouth. And this guy just basically starved to death. And this, I've had countless people, it's not just one nurse, dozens of people have reached out to me because I've obviously quite well known. They've seen me as a focal point to reach out to, and it's heartbreaking. It's some of the stories you hear, some of the stories I've been told will live with me forever.
Yeah. Mr. Olui, thank you for your evidence, sir. You've mentioned something quite interesting, where you've made, in a sense, a separation, or you distinguished between that is staff that knows exactly as to what's going on.
Yes.
They are merely basically just following orders.
Yes.
And then you've mentioned there is staff that knows what is going on, and it is those individuals, in a sense, that basically pushes this narrative. So yes. In the first group, it is, oh, well, this is what I need to do. I know it is wrong, but I just have to do it. I don't have a choice.
Yes.
So the question I want to pose to you, sir, seeing that we are talking about natural law, and in terms of a reference substantive law for this grand jury, it all comes down to that each and every one of us, each and every human being, can differentiate between a right and wrong. Will you then not say that the only reason why we as humanity are actually so caught up in this eugenic trap, it's because we have staff members who know it is wrong, but they basically just go along. Will you actually agree with that statement? Is it then not now time for those staff members to actually say, you know what, I know it is wrong. I am not going to continue to do what I know it is wrong, because like, if they can get to that point, we will be able as humanity to come up against just forces that actually want to kill humanity. Don't you think it is now time, and I want to put you in reference as well also when it came to the Nuremberg trials, and one of the excuses used was that I was just following orders. So is it now not time for those specific staff members in whatever hospital in the world to say that it is time where we have to actually say no, this is where we draw the line?
100%. And I think it's interesting you mention that, because I think many of them, many 80 to 100,000 UK staff have told us that inadvertently, because they're on the very forefront of this deadly pandemic, and yet they'd rather throw away their careers than take the protection. Doesn't that just really coincide with what you've just said? They've told us without saying it, you know, they'd rather lose their jobs than take the protection, because they see firsthand what it's doing to the people that are dying in front of them. You know, why would you not want to take that protection? 80,000 NHS staff would have rather thrown away their career, to the point where the government backtracked because they knew they'd have 80,000 witnesses. We haven't got a Zoom room big enough.
So what do you think then needs to happen? And I completely understand that you are now talking about the 80 to 100,000 that says, no, we are prepared to basically, and that is actually the ones that is on the right side of history. But then we have the ones that you've actually mentioned. They know it is wrong, but they continue to do what they are doing. What needs to happen to those ones?
I think accountability. Once you start making people accountable and they're put into the courts, some of them will break and they'll start pointing fingers, because that's human nature and that's what people do, isn't it? And they'll perhaps very much in the same, history repeats itself, and very much like the Nuremberg trials, their only defense will be, I did what I was told to do. That's the reality. Mm-hmm. You know, times change. People don't.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. And thank you all as well. I feel privileged to be amongst you.
Thank you, John. This was very powerful testimony.
Thank you.
It will move a lot of people. It will turn them in the right direction, I'm sure.
Well, to be honest with you, my testimony is probably the most powerful evidence I have to offer.
You can't do any better than that.
Amen.
Thank you.
God bless you all. I'm going to have to go because I've got commitments.
Sure.
Thank you, everyone, and God bless you all. I'm sure we will win. Let's see if we can get justice. God bless.
We will.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. Now for the good news. There is good news in this. Dr. Shankara Chetty will tell us about this because, as we have learned, this is an illusion. We're not dealing with a corona pandemic, but we're dealing with a PCR test pandemic. And there are ways of treating this virus, which, as the numbers tell us, is no more dangerous than the common flu. Dr. Chetty, what good news can you tell us?
Thank you, Rainer, and thank you to all my colleagues on this platform. This has been a two-year heart-wrenching journey, and I think that we're doing very important work. I think that an understanding of what I've been through in these 2 years will bring understanding to what the people before me had presented and understanding to what actually has transpired. And so I think just a narration of my journey and my understanding of this pandemic can lend a lot to what we're trying to achieve. So for a start, I'd like to start with what transpired before COVID came to South Africa in the first place. I have a background in genetics, in advanced biology, in microbiology, and in biochemistry, besides my general practitioner medical work. And so I'm a very suspicious doctor. I investigate everything, and I make sure that I fall back on the knowledge I've gained in those years of tertiary education and don't really believe things too easily. So before this pandemic came to South Africa, we were told that there was a virus in Wuhan, and it had spread from person to person. It was a respiratory virus, seemed to be highly infectious, and of course with the new virus, we had no understanding of how it killed, how it caused severe illness and death. But we were told it's highly contagious and it could be the start of a new pandemic. The first thing that I found very strange was that the Chinese cordoned off Wuhan, and the virus never spread to any other city in that country. Yet their international borders were left open, and it spread around the globe. So that was the first thing I found very suspicious. We're dealing with a highly contagious virus. Why wasn't it completely contained? And of course, we weren't getting very much information from China, which is, well, what I expected. Now, as a doctor, I needed to plan. When this virus got to my country, I needed to be ready for it. The first thing I noticed that was problematic was this PCR test. They had developed a PCR test to test for the virus itself. Now, with my scientific background, I'm well aware that a PCR test is never used as a diagnostic tool. And so I wondered why this became a norm. As well, we started getting reports of asymptomatic spread, never before heard in medical science. So there were these unusual things coming out. And of course, a PCR test has absolutely no bearing on infectiousness. As the previous people that submitted have alluded to, a PCR test just tests fragments of a virus. It does not test for an infectious complete agent, and it does not tell whether someone is actually infected or infectious. The only thing that tells you that a virus exists is a culture, a cell culture of the virus that proves that the virus can grow, replicate, and spread. So I looked at this PCR test with a little bit of suspicion. And then this PCR test was being used to gauge or to determine public health measures. And the public health measures were sanitation. And of course, we were getting reports that this virus was living on surfaces for 5 days and 10 days and 15 days on different kinds of materials. And that made no sense at all. Viruses do not live that period of time. They require a host to replicate and spread. And there's absolutely no scientific evidence of viruses living on innate surfaces for that length of time. So I started to view this kind of information with a lot of suspicion. Of course, masking was controversial as well. As a doctor, I know that the masking has a limitation. And the science of it tells you that a mask will never prevent you from getting a respiratory virus. It's like putting a fence around your house and thinking you're protected from mosquitoes. The science doesn't add up. So I started looking at all this evidence. And then, of course, they looked at isolation measures. And they wanted people to be isolated for 14 days. So I looked at that and I thought, well, you want people to be isolated for 14 days, but you haven't really established how long the viral illness actually persists for. It's an arbitrary measure, 14 days. So, well, I needed to understand why that came to be, 14 days of all that we could choose. So I had these concerns. As well, with my history in genetics, I was aware of the gain-of-function research being done at the time. I was aware of virology and, of course, genetic warfare, manipulation of viruses. I was aware of the research being done in the Wuhan lab with coronaviruses and around spike protein well before COVID actually came to be. So I had this background knowledge that we're dealing with the coronavirus, and it seems very strange and suspicious that now we have a pandemic following research, ongoing research into coronaviruses. So I had a healthy suspicion that this was a lab leak. Of course, taking that a little further, it might have been an engineered virus. So this was something that I had at the back of my mind from the start of this pandemic. And of course, the unusual things, the PCR tests, the asymptomatic spread, the sanitation measures, lockdowns, isolation, all that kind of thing, have made no scientific sense to me. Now, I was faced with a population that were terrified because they were told not to seek medical attention. They were told to stay away from their doctor, and we as doctors were told not to treat. There's no treatment for this, and we should just do telemedicine, and if a patient deteriorated, refer them to hospital. I'm not the kind of person to capitulate that easily. So with the knowledge that I had, I decided that I'm going to take this on. We needed information about this illness. And without that information about the pathology of this illness, we never solve the problem. Now, I knew once the virus got to Italy that I would get some information about its symptoms. And the things that came out that were unusual, that would allow me to diagnose this without having to use a PCR test, because as doctors, we should diagnose illnesses symptomatically. And so the symptoms that are unique to an illness would give you an indication that you're dealing with that kind of illness. And the symptoms that I found unusual were the loss of smell and taste, which doesn't routinely occur with respiratory viruses, and of course the breathlessness that people were presenting with. And this breathlessness was of very sudden onset, required ventilation very quickly. So the dyspnea and the loss of smell and taste became my diagnostic tool to confirm whether a patient actually had a coronavirus infection or not. And I watched. I needed to get myself a toolbox in preparation for this. So when I looked at this, we're dealing with a respiratory virus. The first drug that came to mind was hydroxychloroquine. Hydroxychloroquine or plasmaquine is well known. It's been used for decades, and it has broad antiviral effects. So if I had to look at something that will curtail the spread of a virus, I would look at that as my mainstay treatment. Now, hydroxychloroquine is being used for many other illnesses like the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis and the rest. So I knew that I'm dealing with a very safe drug that I could ethically give to my patients and assess its efficacy. So I decided on getting stock of hydroxychloroquine. But very quickly, I noticed that the Lancet, that published an article about the toxicity of hydroxychloroquine and its heart cardiac manifestations. And I thought, this is nonsense. I've been treating patients with hydroxychloroquine for many years, and in high doses in some, and I've never had a side effect with it. So I'm a doctor that tends to use medication from Noah's Ark, because I trust the long-term efficacy and safety of those medications. So I bought up as much stock of hydroxychloroquine as I could, and subsequently, 2 days after I did that, the government here in South Africa pulled it from the shelves. So luckily, I had stock of it, and I had prepared for my patients. Patients came to see me very, very distraught that I might close and I might not be available to them. But I reassured all of them that I would brave this out, and I would make sure that I examine every one of them, and I needed to understand what we're actually dealing with. So When the first case of coronavirus was reported in South Africa, I decided that I would fall back on my education. I moved out of my home into isolation to protect my family. My home and my practice are on the same premises. I pitched a tent, a proper clinic tent, outside my practice in the parking lot, because I trust ventilation and sunlight as the best ways to protect myself from this virus. I knew that if I sanitized my hands and kept my hands away from my face, I'd be reasonably well protected, and then I could see every patient. And that was my initial plan for the pandemic. But with the controversy around hydroxychloroquine, with the PCR test being used as a diagnostic tool, with the word that there's asymptomatic spread, I had a very healthy suspicion for what I was being told. And the so-called experts didn't seem to question this. There was no proof of all this. Yet we had government experts punting this narrative. So I started to see patients. From the first patient that walked into my practice, I made sure I examined him. The two things that I wanted to understand was one, the symptomatology. And of course, every patient that came in with a sudden loss of smell and taste, which is unusual, I suspected had a coronavirus infection. So I didn't want to do this PCR test. I didn't want to rely on this PCR test. I knew it was going to skew the numbers from the start. And I could see the worldwide pandemonium and fear that was being created. So when patients came to see me, I started to examine the symptoms. And those that had loss of smell and taste, I assumed had were coronavirus positive. I took the opportunity to test a few. And only those that had loss of smell and taste. And I found them to be positive. So I had confirmed that a loss of smell and taste was a symptom of coronavirus infection. And so I didn't feel the need to test every patient. If a family member had loss of smell and taste and I tested him and he was positive and the rest of the family started an illness at around the same time and presented with the same kind of symptoms, I could safely assume that they had picked up the same infection and would treat them in very much the same way. Now, as a doctor, we are expected to come to a diagnosis with examining our patient. I was never taught to use testing as a diagnostic tool. Testing is only used if I have some confusion in my clinical diagnosis, and it is used to clarify. It is never used as a diagnostic tool. So I do not test patients to tell me what's wrong with them. That's their bad medical practice. We don't go through years of training in clinical practice to use a swab to tell me what's wrong with the patient. So I started to see all these patients with COVID infections. The second thing that I was very interested in was the breathlessness. This was the thing that was causing people to die. But the first few patients that came in to see me had a common flu, a respiratory infection that looked like every other respiratory infection I had seen. They had the body aches and pains and the fever and a bit of a sore throat and, of course, the loss of smell and taste as the unusual symptoms that drew my attention to it being a coronavirus infection. And so I advised every patient that came in to see me that if they had developed breathlessness in any way or form, I would like them to report back to me immediately because I needed to understand exactly where this breathlessness came from and exactly why patients were ending up in hospital. Yes, we knew in hospital that patients were breathless, their oxygen saturations were decreasing, they were being put onto ventilators, and from the information from Italy, we knew that the progression of this breathlessness could be very variable. Some patients had mild breathlessness that didn't progress and seemed to resolve. Some patients had breathlessness that was a little more severe and lasted a very long time. And then, of course, there were those that developed breathlessness very suddenly, progressed very quickly, and within a day or two ended up on a ventilator. And so I noticed that there's a strange change or difference in the speed of the progression of this breathlessness, which I needed to understand. And, of course, understand how we got to that point in the first place. So within the first, I'd say 20 patients that I'd seen, I got the first breathless patient to come in. And of course, by educating my patients, explaining to them the gravity of what we were seeing, and of course there was enough fear-mongering in the world to make sure they presented back to me timeously, every patient that became breathless came back to me exactly on the day they noticed something's wrong. And I found a few things very strange. In these small subset of patients that came back to me breathless, remember, a majority of patients recovered uneventfully, like a normal respiratory infection. They had very few chest symptoms. Most was just a sore throat that resolved in 2 or 3 days, and they had absolutely no sequelae. So when this happened and patients came back to me breathless, I needed to examine them and understand exactly what was happening. Now, I noticed a few very strange things. Quite a few of these patients that presented back to me were perfectly fine the day before the breathlessness started. They had thought that they had completely recovered from the illness. There were patients that had a sore throat for a day, recovered from that sore throat, spent the rest of the week perfectly fine, engaged in sporting activities, and then developed breathlessness suddenly. So this breathlessness was of very sudden onset, and it seemed to always occur exactly 1 week after the first symptom. So when a patient came to me on a Monday, I questioned them, and if the sore throat started on that Monday, I documented that as the onset of symptoms. Now, we know that with viral infections, there are some viruses that run a very distinct course. They replicate for a certain number of days, your immunity kicks in, and then you eliminate that virus. So like chickenpox and measles and those kind of viruses, they run a specific course. They last for a specific period of time. So when patients came back, and I noticed it was always on the 8th day, exactly 1 week after the onset of symptoms, I thought, well, I'm dealing with a virus that has this time frame to it. It exactly 8 days later starts to do something else. There's a new symptom presenting here, and it's not in every patient. It's in a very small subset of patients. And of course, I was seeing what I was told was happening in Italy. Some patients presented to me with a mild onset breathlessness on the 8th day, and some more moderate, and some very severe. Now, part of my toolbox was hydroxychloroquine, and I reserved it for those patients in that first days that had what I thought was the high viral load. So those that had severe body aches and pains and high fevers, I would give hydroxychloroquine to, and I saw within a day or two that I'd managed to break that fever and get them on the way to recovery. Now, every single patient that I have seen in that first phase showed signs of recovery by about the 5th or 6th day, some within a day or two, but a majority by the 5th or 6th day had signs of improvement, had their appetite back, were feeling a lot better. But that did not in any way influence what might transpire on that 8th day. So when I noticed this nuance that people were coming back on this vital 8th day with new symptoms, I started to educate my community about this strange nuance I was seeing. So every patient that came to see me got interrogated. I interrogated very carefully the day they noticed that they were feeling unwell. I used that day to predict when their 8th day would be, and I would warn them of any new symptoms developing on that 8th day so that they would come back to me timely. The second thing I did was I knew from Italy that we're dealing with a steroid responsive illness. And as a doctor, we know that we shouldn't be using steroids in an infection. It must be used very cautiously. It will suppress your immunity and prevent you developing a robust immune response to an infection. And if you suppress immunity, you run the risk of allowing that infection to run rampant unchecked. So I needed to choose a specific point in this illness where steroids would become pertinent to apply. And of course, with the 8th day, that was very obvious, that a deterioration occurred on that 8th day, and that would be the point where a steroid would become appropriate. And of course, with patients showing signs of recovery before, I was pretty confident that our immunity has somehow managed to get a hold of this illness and get it into check. So I started patients promptly on steroids. Those that returned on the eighth day with breathlessness were started on a course of steroid. And by the third or fourth day of steroids, they all showed good signs of recovery. Now, as a doctor, what tells me that something works is speed to recovery. Now, I don't give you a paracetamol tablet for a headache, and when it takes 5 days to go away, assume that the paracetamol worked. Speed to recovery gives me an indication of the efficacy of my treatment, and the efficacy of my treatment and the speed to recovery gives me an indication of the underlying mechanism of this disease. So if I'm treating the wrong thing, I won't have the speed to recovery. So looking at the patients that I treated from the first four or five that presented with this breathlessness and were put onto steroids, and I noticed this difference in the presentation, that means the speed at which the second phase started. I looked at my understanding of pathology and tried to understand why we were getting this variability. The first part of the illness had no relation to the second. Whether you were critically ill in the first 5 days made no difference as to whether you would deteriorate again on the eighth. Because I've had patients critically ill in the first 5 days, recovered, and had no sequelae. And I've had patients with a very mild illness, got over it, and on the eighth day presented with very severe illness. So I knew I'm dealing with a nonlinear illness that was biphasic, and the two phases had no correlation between them. So I was dealing with two pathologies. So to understand the second pathology, I had patients that were diabetic, hypertensive, a lot of comorbidities, and never had the second phase of this illness. And I had patients that were absolutely fit with no comorbidities and had the second phase of this illness. So it didn't seem to be related to any health predisposition. So when you look at pathology, you've got to try and understand what you're dealing with, the facts that are in front of you, and what makes sense. And the only thing that made sense to me was that these people on the eighth day were having some sort of allergic reaction to something. And we know with allergic reactions that a majority of people are not allergic to certain things and will have no reaction, like a bee sting. And some will be mildly allergic, and some moderately allergic, and some severely allergic. And so the difference in speed of presentation and the difference in severity. Of course, if you're mildly allergic to a bee sting, you will get a bit of an itch on the sting, and in a few days it would be self-limiting and seem to sort itself out. However, if you were more moderately allergic, that bee sting might cause a rash throughout your body, and if I do not treat it, it will take a long time for that rash to subside, though it may never end up life-threatening. And then, of course, if you're very allergic to a bee sting and I don't treat you, within a day or two, you're going to end up with severe organ damage and end up in ICU and probably die from that. So I thought, well, if I'm dealing with this kind of pathology, a type 1 mediated hypersensitivity reaction, then a therapeutic trial is in order. Now, a therapeutic trial is something every doctor does with almost every patient. When a patient comes to see me, I have an inclination of a diagnosis, and then I give them some medication, but dependent on that diagnosis, which is a therapeutic trial. And if that medication that I give them shows benefit and they improve, then it confirms my diagnosis and I don't need to do anything further. I don't need to go test them to prove I was correct. They recover completely. So my understanding that I'm dealing with a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction drove me to improve and fine-tune the toolbox that I was using. At that point in time, it was just hydroxychloroquine, symptomatic treatment, and of course a steroid from day 8. So the sixth patient that came in to see me was a 40-year-old female who had developed breathlessness on that very day, who was, like a lot of the others, perfectly fine the day before. It was actually her eighth day of illness, and her saturations had dropped to 80% in that one day. Yesterday she was fine. Being diabetic, hypertensive, and obese, I was a bit concerned. But I knew I had to start a steroid. But I'm dealing with a critically ill patient. So I thought, well, if this is an allergic reaction, then a few other drugs become pertinent and I need to add them and test them and watch the speed to recovery. So the first thing I added to her treatment was promethazine. Now, promethazine is a drug, an antihistamine, an old generation antihistamine, that is used to treat severe allergic reactions. It is an essential drug, World Health Organization approved, that every doctor should have in his emergency kit. So when a patient comes in with the bee sting, a steroid and promethazine are the drugs of choice. So I added a dose of promethazine to her treatment. To be cautious, I gave her a kiddie's dose, a 10 milligram. Usually we use 25 milligrams 3 times a day in adults to 4 times a day. I gave her a 10 milligram tablet and said, take it 3 times a day. It was just for one day, that particular day that she came in. And I told my staff to please contact her tomorrow and look at speed to recovery. Has it made a difference to her improvement? And the very next day when we contacted her, she was busy washing the dishes and she was perfectly fine. The breathlessness had gone completely. But I had given her a single dose and I expected a rebound. So I advised her to please be cautious because I would expect the breathlessness to resurface if this is an allergy, and we would have to suppress this for a little while. And of course, the very next day she was breathless again, and I reinstituted the antihistamine, and she recovered promptly. So it was at that point that I realized that I'm dealing with a severe allergic trigger. And I added, now with an allergic reaction, you get the release of certain chemical mediators, histamine, leukotrienes, prostaglandins and prostacyclins, and platelet activating factor. Now, the modality when you treat an allergic reaction is to use a high enough dose of steroid to turn off this inappropriate immune tap that has been turned on. The second thing you do is mop up all the mediators that have spilled already. And this is where timelessness is important. The longer you leave it, the more the mediators, the more the damage. And to mop up those mediators, histamine is addressed by antihistamines, leukotrienes by montelukast, platelet activating by either an anticoagulant or aspirin. Prostaglandins and prostacyclins are dual kind of mediators that are beneficial and so don't actually need to be addressed. So I added montelukast and aspirin to my protocol very early on. And that has been the modality of my treatment. I knew about the inflammation, the cytokine storm, the thrombotic events that were seen in patients. However, I was of the opinion that this was a hypersensitivity triggered by some sort of viral debris on the 8th day. And that hypersensitivity trigger, left unchecked, would lead to hyperinflammation, like we saw in hospital settings. And if that hyperinflammation leading to a cytokine storm was not addressed appropriately, it would lead to thrombosis and so all the clots. And that has been my modality of treatment through the pandemic. The first thing with this kind of treatment that I found very strange was that the World Health Organization had put out this recommendation that we should isolate patients for 14 days. That I found to be the most disastrous kind of advice you could give anyone, especially if they were going to have a severe allergic reaction on the 8th day that couldn't be predicted. They needed to be told about this. And like a bee sting, if you had a bee sting and came to me on the 8th day and I said, well, there's nothing I can do about this, you wait at home and let's see what happens. By the time you realize that you are critically ill, you will have multi-system organ damage. And then you would present yourself to hospital. And when you presented yourself to hospital, the doctor in hospital is unaware you were stung with the bee. And he would have absolutely no idea where to start treating you. He would just be trying to keep you alive. And so I had remarkable recoveries from the start. I've had patients present to me with saturations of 70% and on the first dose of treatment had that 70% improved to 85% within an hour and an hour and a half. There's no other medication besides the antihistamine that has shown that speed to recovery. And because I managed to reverse the hypoxia so timeously in these patients, I didn't have the need for oxygen in my practice. Now, I'm well aware of the so-called experts and peers that are out there dictating what we should do. And it's the reason I've been a controversial doctor all my life. I don't tend to follow the rules. I tend to follow the science. And that makes me controversial. My staff noticed these remarkable improvements. they were well aware of the rural population dying at home and the mortality and morbidity of not getting treatment. We were also well aware of the patients dying in hospital. I was also well aware that remdesivir was being punted. I knew that remdesivir was toxic. I knew that it caused kidney failure. It caused cardiac issues. And I saw those things, like the presenters before me alluded to. None of my patients got into any kidney problems. None of my patients got into any cardiac problems. And of course, on clinical examination of these patients, it was not a COVID pneumonia I was dealing with. It was not progressive. Patients were perfectly fine the day before. When they came to me breathless, they were not acutely ill. They were tired. They were breathless. But from afar, they were perfectly fine. And when I examined them clinically, they had no crepitations. They had none of the symptoms that you would associate with the pneumonia. But they did have breathlessness. So I was under the impression that I am dealing with a hypersensitivity trigger on the eighth day in a subset of patients that are allergic to something in this virus. And that hypersensitivity was causing a hypersensitivity pneumonitis, which would develop at different speeds depending on your allergic propensity to the allergen. And so I treated it as such. And so my staff spoke to me about writing an article and giving this out to other doctors. Now, understanding that I had the suspicion from the start that we're dealing with a lab-made virus, and of course we were told that there's a bat coronavirus that jumps species to human beings. Now, the one thing that would change on a virus that would make it jump species to a different host is its receptor. And spike protein being the receptor on this virus, spike protein was on my radar from the start as the possible allergen because it's new. We've been exposed to coronavirus previously and we've never seen this kind of pathology, allergy. And so when you're exposed to a new environment, there might be something that you were never exposed to in that new environment that you might be allergic to. So I was suspicious that spike protein, free spike protein, was the trigger on the eighth day causing these problems. So I published this article, hoping to educate doctors. Well, I wrote the article, hoping to educate doctors and patients, and use this knowledge that I have found to save lives. And that is where the trouble started. I shared the article with all the hospitals in my area before it was published. I made sure that every person that could have some impact on this pandemic was aware of what I had discovered. The hospitals were using antivirals. I found that absolutely illogical. Now, I was of the opinion that the virus was gone by the fifth or sixth day. And so I started looking at studies around the world. And there are no studies around the world that have managed to culture this virus past the seventh day. Yes, the PCR test remained positive for a month in some patients, but that's no indication of a live virus. So I chose carefully what to believe. So I looked at the data and I looked at culture results. And there were a lot of results showing culture positivity in the first 7 days. And that tied into what I saw. People had a viral infection. But post 7 days, there were very few, if any, culture positive results in hospitalized patients. So I knew that the virus had left. And that confirmed clearly to me that we were dealing with a separate pathology post eighth day. So I wrote this article and I shared it freely with our Minister of Health here in South Africa, with the president of my country, with all the stakeholders that I could think of, with every doctor I knew. But I was very cautious because I was well aware with the controversy around hydroxychloroquine, with the misinformation that was given to me about sanitation, isolation, PCR testing, masking, asymptomatic spread, that there was a bigger plan at play. So I was very cautious about getting involved in the governmental regulatory structures. I didn't want what I had found to be suppressed. So I thought, well, I'll share it freely, but I'll share it amongst doctors and patients. And if I could teach doctors to treat COVID and make patients understand when to present, then I don't need anyone's permission to save lives. And so that was what I did. I passed it on to every journal I could think of to see who would be willing to publish it. The response from every journal, Nature, it was almost every journal in the world. My wife helped me with that, submitted to every journal. The response I got from journals was either that we need copyright to your work, or we only publish from our subscribers. And I'm not a subscriber to all the medical journals. So I thought very strange, as the custodians of knowledge, as journals claim to be, you cherry pick where you take that knowledge from. So immediately I knew that I'm dealing with some sort of collusion, medical collusion. After all, I had found something that could save us from this pandemic, and no one seemed to want to listen. I also shared it with my professor and principal at the university I studied at in India, and my colleagues on that group, and I had an immediate response from them. My principal wrote back to me immediately thanking me for my work, and so did my colleagues. And so India knew about my discovery very early on in the pandemic. They understood my work with hydroxychloroquine. They understood the hypersensitivity trigger. I had also tried ivermectin. The reason I used ivermectin was because I was dealing with the pulmonary hypersensitivity, and ivermectin is used to clear eosinophils from the lung. And that was the rationale behind me trying it, and it worked. I mentioned that to my colleagues in India, and ivermectin became a thing there in the first wave. And so India was the only country that held my hand through the first wave of this pandemic. I was completely ignored by the rest. Then in August that year, Modern Medicine, an academic journal here in South Africa, contacted me to publish my article. I had insisted that it gets published unabridged and unedited, because it had some things in there that would be of great impact and influence on the pandemic. Seeing that we were dealing with a hypersensitivity reaction, that had some grave consequences and some implications for how we managed the pandemic. One, in the first wave, we saw people over 55 dying. Now, remember, all the death in this pandemic comes from the second part of the illness, not the first. And the second part is an allergic reaction. So I was of the opinion that people over 55 were actually exposed to some sort of coronavirus that was very similar to this before, and they had developed the necessary antibodies. Now remember, if you are allergic to something, your first exposure does not cause illness. You need to be sensitized first. So your second exposure onwards creates the problem. So I was of the opinion that people over 55 were sensitized, and so they had a severe allergic reaction, or those that were allergic, and that's the reason we saw deaths above 55 years of age. However, those below 55 would be sensitized in the first wave, and from the second wave on, I expected that people below 55 would die. They would have the allergic reaction because they are now sensitized, and we would see younger people die. And that was one of the gravest predictions of the article that I wrote. The second was to understand risk. Who is actually at risk in this pandemic? Because we had shut off the entire planet indiscriminately. Everyone had to stay home. But if we knew who was at risk, then we could risk stratify more effectively. And to risk stratify, we would need to find the specific IgE subtype for the allergen and see who is allergic. And those are the people at highest risk of having the second phase, and of course at highest risk of mortality and morbidity. And so my article covered all these different parts to this pandemic. The one thing that made my article very controversial was that I expressed an opinion saying that if early treatment, like I had seen personally myself, if early treatment could curb all the mortality and morbidity of COVID illness, it would make a vaccine to a mutagenic RNA virus rushed to market wholly unnecessary. And I think that was all the controversy that my article then caused. When we got into the second wave, I needed proof of my eighth day, and I needed proof of what was happening. None of the local labs were willing to test patients with COVID. You would only get tertiary service if you were hospitalized. So I had to rely on clinical improvement of my patients to make adjustments to their medication to get them to recover. And I managed to do this. So I contacted the local lab to say, look, I need assistance with this work once it was published in Modern Medicine, an academic journal. And the local lab then offered me their services, willing to give me a research grant to look further into this. But being a commercial lab, they did not have the capacity to develop testing for a specific IgE subtype to see who is most at risk. I mean, we can tell if you're allergic to milk by the very same test. We can tell if you're allergic to wheat by the very same test. This is not rocket science. All we need to do is understand what the allergen is and then see who's allergic to that particular allergen. So I started to check IgE levels and started to do some blood testing as the second wave came by. But in the first wave, one other thing I need to mention is all the patients that I've treated, some 800 of them, I never had a single long COVID case. So I was of the opinion that the mild cases resolve spontaneously, talking about people allergic and presenting on the eighth day. The moderate cases were not treated, and those were the long COVID cases that were sitting with an untreated moderate long-term allergy. And of course, the very severe cases needed quick aggressive treatment, and if not, were the ones that were ending up on the ventilator. And of course, the diagnosis of pulmonary hypersensitivity rather than COVID pneumonia may put ventilation into a very poor light. Ventilation is absolutely the wrong way to treat a hypersensitivity pneumonitis. So I was of the opinion that the world had misdiagnosed a pandemic, calling it a COVID pneumonia rather than a hypersensitivity pneumonitis, and all the mortality and morbidity resided in the second part, caused by an allergen, not the virus itself. In the second wave, we had the South African variant. Now, just so I'll reiterate later on, in the first wave, we had mostly black patients present to me. I had not a single Indian patient, not a single colored patient, and not a single white patient in the first wave. It was all black patients. Now, I assumed that that would be because of their inability to isolate. They live in communities in close proximity, and I thought that was the reason I was seeing it spreading in that community. However, in the second wave, we had what we call the notorious South African variant. And looking at the genetics around that variant, the only thing that had really changed was the spike protein. The mutation caused the change in spike protein. And so when we got the cases coming in, I needed again to look at the symptoms and the presentation to understand what's going on. And of course, it was very strange that only the spike protein mutated. Nothing else in the virus changed. And that's not how natural mutations occur. So it reinforced my understanding that I'm dealing with a lab-made virus here. When you look at genetic manipulation, besides engineering a virus, you can also engineer the mutations that occur every so many cycles. So you can engineer the mutagenicity of a virus. So in the second wave, we had the South African variant with the new spike protein. Symptomatically, we had a more contagious virus. It spread very quickly in families, in communities. And of course, that ties in with the change in spike protein, having a greater affinity for its host. Of course, the symptomatology changed. I was seeing a lot more gastrointestinal symptoms. I wasn't seeing the respiratory symptoms. Patients were presenting with a very mild sore throat that went away in a day, but they had runny tummies, heartburn, reflux, a lot of gastrointestinal symptoms. And that told me that the change in spike protein had given it affinity for ACE receptors in the gut. Again, a change in spike protein, a change in affinity for receptor. And then the eighth day remained the same. There were a subset of patients who deteriorated on the eighth day, but that deterioration had changed. Now those patients that deteriorated on the eighth day presented with gastrointestinal symptoms, a re-emergence of gastrointestinal symptoms. So I knew that the eighth day was now an allergic reaction again, but not an allergic reaction triggered in your lungs like the first wave had done. This allergic reaction was triggered in your gut. But with progress, would lead to hyperinflammation, would lead to coagulation, and would eventually lead to breathlessness. So I was again seeing breathlessness, but no more on the eighth day. There was a worsening of symptoms, gastrointestinal symptoms on the eighth day, but the breathlessness took 2 or 3 days to develop. And that is the progression of allergy. I treated those patients in very much the same way, catching them on the eighth day, being quick and aggressive to treating them, and all of them resolved. But what the second wave drew to my attention or confirmed was my suspicion that spike protein was the culprit. Because on the eighth day, in the second wave, I was seeing far more severe allergic reactions that required far more aggressive intervention to curb it. Now, speed to recovery, again, was the measure of what I needed to do. The dose of steroid that worked in the first wave was taking far longer to curb this in the second wave and needed to be increased. The longer that cap stayed open, the bigger the problem was going to be. And so in the second wave, I used a far higher dose of steroid, but the rest of my treatment remained almost the same. And of course, that implicated spike protein. Now, this was at the end of 2020 during the second wave, and it was at the point where vaccines were going to be rolled out to the world. Now, at this point, I had clarified that the primary pathogen of COVID illness was not coronavirus at all. Coronavirus was a vector. It caused a transient respiratory illness, and our immunity was strong enough to deal with it. But once our immunity dealt with the virus, the debris left behind from this eighth day caused an allergic reaction in those that were sensitive to spike protein. And so people that were allergic to spike protein would have this reaction. So spike protein became the primary pathogen of COVID illness. And spike protein was the reason for all the mortality and all the morbidity. I had not a single patient demise in the first 7 days of this illness. So spike protein now clearly was the pathogen I was dealing with. And of course, being a pathogen, it was causing allergy. Now, the vaccines that were being developed at the time, messenger RNA vaccines, were all designed to get your body to make spike protein. Now, spike protein being the primary pathogen of COVID illness, that was a dangerous game to be playing. We have many other parts of this virus that we could have chosen that were more stable, that could have been used to make a vaccine. For some reason, spike protein was chosen. So I hoped that my work would draw attention to the danger of using spike protein to make a vaccine. And so I brought this to people's attention, but again, I was ignored. So I knew that there is some ulterior motive at play. And so knowing that the vaccines will not be stopped, my research, understanding, and push became about looking at spike protein, not being distracted by the virus, and trying to understand what spike protein would do in the human body. Now, remember, when you have a coronavirus infection and you're exposed to free spike protein on the eighth day, it is a set dose of spike protein, and it will only harm you if you're allergic to it. But if you're not, your body will clear it away. But if you are given a vaccine that gets your body to make spike protein, now you will be exposed to spike protein for a prolonged period. And so spike protein does not only now have an allergenic potential, it will now have a biologic effect on your body. To put that into perspective, a drug like penicillin, its biologic effect on your body is that it's an antibiotic. But for it to have that biologic effect, you need to take the full course. Now, if I had to give every person on this planet a single dose of penicillin, it will not have that biologic effect of an antibody, an antibiotic. But if I gave every single person on this planet a single dose of penicillin, and then I denied them medical care for 14 days, every person that was severely allergic to penicillin would die of an allergic reaction. And that's what happened with COVID infection. People were denied treatment to a simple allergic reaction. But with the vaccine and being exposed to spike protein for a prolonged period, like being exposed to penicillin for a prolonged period, it starts to act as an antibiotic. So I needed to understand what a prolonged exposure to spike protein would do to the human body. And that has been the focus of my research and understanding ever since spike protein got implicated. In the third wave, we had very much the same happen again. We found that patients presented with symptoms. Again, gastroenteritis was gone. We've had saw patients coming in with sore throats again. The symptoms had changed, and of course the spike protein had changed. On the eighth day, patients were not breathless. Patients were not having gastroenteritis, but they presented with an overwhelming sudden onset of fatigue. And so I started to advise patients about that symptom on the eighth day, and if it occurred, to present timeously. We saw that the allergic reaction in the third wave seemed to affect the vessels more than anything else. And patients were developing clots, emboli, and that seemed to be the trigger here. So it seemed like we were again having an allergic reaction on the eighth day, but the allergic reaction was focused on the circulatory system. And so again, the same treatment was instituted with the same results. Every patient that came in on the eighth day with an overwhelming sense of fatigue was started on the treatment protocol for a severe allergic reaction, and they all timeously improved. And all this got confirmed now that I had access to laboratory findings by measuring interleukin-6 values, CRPs, and D-dimers. And I could clearly show the exponential rise in these values from the eighth day in those patients who had symptoms. And I could clearly show the turnaround back to normal once I had treated them. And the turnaround was timeous again. I had every patient of mine almost completely recovered, irrespective of how severely they presented to me post eighth day, within a week. I've had patients present to me with saturations of 40% on oxygen, brought to me with an ambulance on a drip. And in a week, I had them on home treatment at 98% saturation on room air. And the timeous reversal of the hypoxia negated the need for any supplementary oxygen. So in the third wave, I realized the change in spike protein changed the system that was being affected by the allergy. And of course, I noticed something else unusual. In the second wave, it was mostly patients of Indian descent that came and saw me. There were no black patients anymore in the second wave. It was all patients of Indian descent. And then in the third wave, it was very few patients that were black or of Indian descent, and it was mostly the white population and the Muslim population that was affected in that wave. And I thought that to be very strange, because I had assumed that it was the black population in the first wave because of their social circumstance. Then I looked at the world around me, and I found exactly the same happened in America. The first wave affected the African-American population more than anyone else. The second wave ravaged India, and I had more Indian patients see me here in South Africa. And then in the third wave, it affected the Caucasian population globally and the Muslim population globally. So that drew my attention to something far more sinister. I knew that I was dealing with an engineered virus. I assumed that it was a lab leak, but I also had at the back of my mind the understanding that this might have been pre-planned. And if you had a virus, the different variants, that seemed to affect different systems, a propensity for different systems, respiratory in the first variant, gastrointestinal in the second, and circulatory in the third, and had a propensity for certain ethnicity, that's a very bad omen. Because if this was pre-planned, then it's a preamble to ethnic cleansing. It's an understanding of how to affect different systems and how to affect different population groups with the mutations that you engineer into a virus. And so I knew at that point that I'm probably dealing with a bioweapon. And so my research has all been in that direction. I've pushed researchers to stop looking at the virus and to start looking at spike protein. And we needed to understand what the spike protein was doing, because I knew that Pfizer and the likes were going to expose the entire planet to this biologic agent called spike protein. And so we started looking at long COVID. we started looking at vaccine injuries. Now with long COVID, when I started seeing patients with long COVID, I started testing IgE levels to try and prove that I'm dealing with the hypersensitivity, and every single one of them had elevated levels. And that confirmed for me that we're dealing with hypersensitivity. Subsequently, Kenneth Day and Marcus Sanchez published an article about the lethality of COVID illness, speculating that the lethality was caused by a hypersensitivity pneumonitis, not a COVID pneumonia. And I proved that clinically. Recently, an article was published from China that looked at the use of steroids, but also looked at the specific IgE subtype for spike protein, means what I wanted to do. Look for those that are allergic to spike protein. And they found a direct correlation between severity of illness and IgE specific to spike protein levels, which proved conclusively that on that eighth day, we were dealing with a hypersensitivity trigger. There was an allergic reaction which was being left unchecked, and it was causing all the death we see and all the damage we see. Now, from long COVID and from the understanding of vaccine side effects, researchers have looked into the structure of spike protein and what its long-term effect on the human body would be. We know that it causes endothelial injury and will damage your blood vessels. And if it damages those blood vessels, it would cause clotting in various areas of the body. And those people that are predisposed to vessel damage, like your diabetics, your hypertensives, are most at risk of having this damage become clinically significant. The second thing we noticed is that it causes an immune-mediated damage to the myocardium in the heart. And so we've seen the myocarditis in young children. We've seen the clots. We've noticed these things with the vaccine. The other thing that was discovered was that the vaccine, spike protein, has similarities to other pathogenic proteins that we know of. One of them being the proteins made during HIV illness that actually causes immunosuppression. Now, if the spike protein caused immunosuppression, then we would expect to see a reemergence of latent infections like Epstein-Barr, like herpes zoster. We'd expect to see a reemergence of cancers that were in remission, and we would expect to see a waning of immunity over time and people exposed to spike protein becoming more prone to illness. And we've seen that with the vaccines, and we've seen that with COVID. We've seen people that are vaccinated actually being more prone to developing severe illness. Now, the claim from the vaccine manufacturers that the vaccines prevent severe illness and death. I find that amazing that they could make that claim. They've refused to accept my work on the pathogenesis of COVID illness. I think simply because I have proven that spike protein is the primary pathogen. And if you accept that spike protein is the primary pathogen, that shows the vaccines in a very dangerous light. Now, if you don't accept what causes severe illness and death, how can you claim that your product can prevent it? So they have absolutely no pathologic evidence or pathophysiologic evidence of the working of their vaccine. We know that it's not a vaccine because it doesn't prevent infection and transmission. Now, it exposes you to spike protein. So clearly, if you're allergic to spike protein, the vaccine works as a desensitization tool. So we do desensitization for patients that are allergic to certain allergens. We expose them to mild doses of those allergens, and then they become more tolerant. So the vaccine is giving people that are prone to severe illness and death, by exposure to spike protein, which is the allergen, a little bit of tolerance for a limited period of time. And once that vaccine stops making spike protein, you become intolerant to it again, and it no more has the ability to prevent severe illness and death. And we've seen that globally. Then as well with spike protein, it is a membrane protein. And we've seen with the Japanese studies that it circulates throughout the body. Now, every tissue that is exposed to spike protein and starts to make spike protein will express it on its surface. It will be recognized as foreign. And that will trigger a host of autoimmune conditions, which we've seen as well. We've also seen that spike protein crosses the nucleus into the nucleus of the cell. It inhibits the BRCA protein, which is used to repair double-stranded DNA breaks. And so it will impact on your DNA's ability to repair itself. And that would cause an explosion in cancers, because cells that actually remain viable after DNA damage are most likely to become cancerous. And all this bears out with long COVID and the vaccine adverse side effects that we've seen, the increase in all-cause mortality that we've noticed globally since the vaccine. And if you look at the trend in that all-cause mortality, it is exactly what we predicted the vaccine would do. We're seeing the neuropathies, we're seeing the blood clots, we're seeing the myocarditis, we're seeing the emergence of latent infections, we're seeing the re-emergence of cancers, we're seeing Alzheimer's, dementia, neuropathies. We are seeing all these things. Now, when we come to Omicron, Omicron started here in South Africa and immediately everyone shut their borders. I thought that was absolutely unnecessary. It was almost a vaccine that we could use as a mild attenuated vaccine. But I was also suspicious that Omicron, with all the changes we saw in it, might be a new engineered vaccine virus. Because now suddenly we had 30 new mutations in the spike protein. And like the previous guests have alluded to, that is not natural. So I had it at the back of my mind that this might be the Christmas present we all wanted, but there might be a sting in its tail. And so I watched Omicron very carefully. The only system that was not affected by COVID infection was the neurologic system. But we saw the neuropathy in the vaccine side effects. So I knew that spike protein had the potential to injure your nerves. And so I looked at Omicron in that light. And with Omicron, it became clearly evident that it was neurotoxic. A lot of the patients that I've seen have presented with neuropathy, burning of their hands and feet, strange sensations around their body, migraine-like headaches, pain radiating from their neck. It seemed to affect C6-7, brachial plexus kind of neuropathy. It seemed to affect T10 and 11 in your spine, which affects the diaphragm. And people had all these strange symptoms. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for giving all that information and being so elaborative. I'm actually also looking that we still have a few witnesses that still have evidence.
Yes, I'm actually done. That was the last. Omicron is where it all ended and where we are.
Okay, awesome. But as you are actually about to wrap up as well, also therapeutic trials, that's basically what you were talking about, modality of treatment and hypersensitivity. You have covered everything in relation to those three pointers.
Yes.
Okay. So what I want to ask you is that I have now, even the jury and the citizens of the world have seen that when it comes to SARS-CoV-2, it is not a death sentence without a shadow of a doubt. It can be treated. And you have very brilliantly set out as well also your treatment plan. So my question to you, what is currently happening all over the world in each and every country, will you agree with me that the government is actually practicing medicine on the population, and as a consequence of that, they are actually standing in the way of like doctors like yourself to give suitable life-saving treatments. Will you agree with that statement, sir?
I will agree with it completely. Doctors are not left to make the decisions they are trained to make, and they are being made by people that are wholly untrained.
So then you will say, so yes, it is then in agreement that the government needs to step aside and they need to trust in the medical doctors. I mean, can you then also then at the same time tell us What is your success rate, percentage-wise?
I've been through over 10,000 patients that I've seen myself, physically myself. I have not had a single death. I have not hospitalized a single patient, and I have not put a single patient on oxygen. There were four deaths in my practice, but four deaths were because of an overabundance of caution by family members who wanted those patients hospitalized. When those patients were put in hospital, the doctors there refused to collaborate with me. My treatment was stopped. They were put onto hospital protocols, and those were the only four deaths that I've had in my practice.
So will you then say when it comes to your treatment plan, you've got a 100% success rate?
I would say that without a shadow of doubt. And I have doctors around the world that are trained with the same protocol, and I've had exactly the same success.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
Yes. Thank you very much, Shankara. This is the good news at the end of the day, so to speak.
I hope it throws light on what's transpiring around us and the plan around us, that there's more than meets the eye.
I agree. Now, since it is very late, are there any comments that you, Mike, or you, Thomas, or you, Sonia, would like to add to this? Does that change any of your views that you have expressed earlier, or does this confirm what you have said? And Dolores, of course. So it seems like...
Mike, you're muted. I think you were trying to say something.
Yeah.
Yes, I was just going to say, really, that I think in great detail, Dr. Shetty has illustrated some things I think they're worth saying. And I often say this to people, don't be scared of the virus. It's, it's a middling kind of virus. We now know that the infection fatality ratio, certainly the current strain, is approximates flu. And if it approximates flu, please, people of the jury, then we shouldn't be taking, unreasonable, oppressive totalitarian steps. And not only is it a similar fatality to flu, but it's very treatable. And there are a variety of treatment protocols, early treatments. You will know about this. But the thing that drew me as an experienced R&D professional into this game, and I think very early in the UK, was that I noticed the government and their advisors lying to us. In fact, I think I've famously given many interviews where I featured COVID lies. And they would tell us that this virus is much more serious than it actually is, and then told us things that we needed to do that are not true, like masking and lockdowns and border closures, school closures, mass testing. And I just want to point out to people that until 2019, all countries had a pandemic preparedness plan, which involved none of those things. The pandemic preparedness plan on the WHO website and the UK website simply said, if you are symptomatic, stay home and wash your hands more often. None of the other things, none of the other things have ever been used. And yet, I point out to people that in March 2020, all of the countries discarded those simple time-honored plans, and they all adopted the same set of crazy oppressive measures that in large measure continue to this day. They've kind of burned them into the global consciousness. But I just need to point out to you, none of them were validated. They were all, most of them actually were analyzed in 2019 by scientists at WHO. You can find that review, and they tested, they showed that masks have been tested and have no impact whatsoever on respiratory virus transmission, and that school closures, border closures, business closures also didn't affect transmission. And that's because the only people who are good sources of transmission are symptomatic. And when people are symptomatic, they generally stay home and out of circulation. So I point that out to people because the only conceivable way dozens and dozens of countries all at the same time would throw away the plans they've used for decades and adopt a set of crazy measures that don't work, and many of which were actually proven previously in the previous year not to work, were all adopted at once. I'm afraid the only way that could have happened is if you had a supranational plan to do that. And so don't be frightened of the virus. It's treatable. Do be frightened of the government's measures that aren't evidence and they're all doing it at the same time. So that's lies. We're not going to talk about it today, but the second risk you should be frightened of and not the virus are the vaccines. And I'm afraid the third risk, which frightens me as much as the other two, is our general passivity as citizens of free countries. We're accepting these measures that we should not. And I'm glad to see people in Canada in particular saying they've had enough, rightly so. Until we all show that we've had enough, the people who have brought about the global lies that I mentioned early on, I think will keep pushing. They'll keep pushing. And if you just wait for it to pass, it will never pass. But just very briefly, I went to excellent presentations earlier on PCR. And I really wanted just to point out a few things. One is that there are very many scores of respiratory viruses. People can have a variety of symptoms that can often be quite similar. So people say to me, well, if these COVID tests, PCR tests aren't reliable, how come my grandfather died? And I've said, well, they were symptomatic almost certainly with something else. And you can have a false positive from people who aren't symptomatic at all and aren't certainly not ill from this particular virus. So it's worth being aware that the normal respiratory viral infections that we've all known throughout our lives still exist. So this insertion of this inaccurate PCR test when positive does not mean suddenly you've all got COVID. You could probably still have influenza, rhinoviruses, adenoviruses, and coronaviruses, by the way. And then in terms of just building on very briefly on the theme of bad mass testing, I happen to specialize in the UK system because that's where I was living. And I pushed and pushed, and I could not get the people involved in mass testing to agree that there was a false positive rate of any test. Every single test, if you do this in hospital laboratories, you always want to know what's the rate of false positives, the operational false positive rate. You need to know what that is in the context you're doing it. And some of the super labs in the UK doing very large numbers of tests, eventually hundreds of thousands of tests a day, they never conceded that there were any fraction of those tests that were positive that were false. And they would only declare the positive results as the number. So that's how many cases there were. And that means if you had a 1% false positive rate and you tested 1 million people, you'd get 10,000 cases. But actually, net of false positives is actually zero. So poor UK lab technique in the bulk labs. They were also recruiting, and this must be true around the world, they were recruiting people to perform those tests who were not properly trained as diagnosticians. They had usually a science degree. They didn't have to have ever worked in the lab. They were taught how to use pipettes. And as Professor Kammerer said, if you've got poor pipetting technique, you can easily contaminate your work area, even if there was a small number of genuine positives in those clinical samples. Poor technique will contaminate your work area. And I think that's why they deliberately hired people who weren't very good at what they were doing and had to be shown what to do, almost knowing that that poor technique would increase the number of false positives. A friend of mine even went to work in one of those labs, a very experienced PCR scientist. And I asked him afterwards, from the techniques you observed, what do you think the false positive rate would be just from bad technique? And he looked at me and he said, any number you like, 0.1, 1, 15, I don't know. He said, it's that bad, you should utterly disregard the statistics coming out of this laboratory. And it was the biggest one in England at the time. So probably haven't really got anything else to say, but I hope people will, if they listen to anything I've said in the past, and will tie it back to today, that we're being lied to, that the measures that are being imposed are inappropriate, are damaging, you know, to the economy, our society, and that we should be frightened of that and not the virus, which is very treatable. Because if we don't eventually, you know, peacefully but en masse, rise up and throw off this oppressive regime, I just don't think we'll ever recover our freedom.
Thank you, Mike. I think this will have a great impact on a lot of people, as this is a jury of the people. we do believe that this will have an impact in the sense that they will start to rise up, because that seems to be the only solution to what we're facing currently. After everything I've heard today, we have to appeal to the people, to the jury of the people, to stop this. Now, as it's a very late hour already, I would like to ask you, Thomas, to save your conclusion for after the vaccination session, because that is another important thing. And after that, I think it'll make even more sense than tonight to summarize what we are witnessing according to what we've heard tonight in particular. Is that okay with you, Thomas?
Yes, okay. I will be there. Okay.
Thank you very much. Now, unless there is anything else that we need to ask our experts, I would suggest that we adjourn this hearing until next Saturday, when we will continue with the vaccinations. Is that okay with everyone?
That's in order with me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, for having joined us and for helping in this endeavor to stop the pandemic and hold all of those who are responsible for this plandemic liable in the courts of law. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you. We will see you all next Saturday. Thank you, Dolores.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.